to order, and out of deference to my good friend from Ontario, I'm going to open a public hearing on HJM3. Sandy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. HJM3 is a memorial that is expressing support for the participation of Taiwan in the World Health Organization. Representative Butler is the chief sponsor of that.
Representative Butler, I am going to get you a new hat, by the way. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think that's fighting words for Representative Butler.
Oh, absolutely. I've almost grown attached to it.
Good morning.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, Tom Butler from House District 60. It's my pleasure today to bring to you House Joint Memorial Number 3, which is a memorial, as Sandy has indicated, to express our state's encouragement for the World Health Organization to bring within its membership Taiwan. Taiwan is a very close trading relationship with the state of Oregon. It continues to be one of the one of our best and brightest stars as we continue to move forward. Next to Japan, Taiwan, as a democracy, has the most vibrant economy of any European or of any Asian economy. As a democracy, and we want to support their efforts. And they have this past month, the cultural office in Seattle has received several states. Memorials indicating their support for the Taiwan's admission to the World Health Organization, and of course the U.S. House of Representatives on the 5th of this month has also passed a resolution encouraging that continued participation and a level of a seat at the table for and on behalf of Taiwan. With that, I make this offer to you and encourage your support for House Joint Memorial Number 3.
Any questions? One question, if indeed we were to pass this thing, would you like to be the carrier?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler. If nobody else signed up to testify, I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM3 and open a work session on HJM3.
Mr. Chairman, I move we move House Joint Memorial 3 to the floor. You pass.
Representative Barker moves House Joint Memorial 3 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Belfield.
Excused.
Representative
Montanus. Aye.
Representative
Tonet.
Aye.
Representative Williams. Aye. Aye. House Joint and Representative Butler will carry. House Joint Memorial 3, having received the constitutionally required majority, is declared passed. And we will close the work session on HJM3 and open a work session on House Bill 2325. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2325 is back before us today with the Dash 2 amendments. As you recall, we heard testimony from the Health Licensing Office on February 7th on this bill. The bill modifies the relationship between the Health Licensing Offices and the 9 board and councils and programs that it administers. The Dash 2 amendment basically changes and updates old language that was in statute to more current language. And for example, what's in current statute is the phrase sanitarians, which is being changed to environmental health specialists, wastewater sanitarians to wastewater specialists, and it also has multiple citations for the other boards and programs. It's a very lengthy amendment. Sue Wilson is here if you folks have any questions.
Are there any questions of the committee? Sue, where are you? Just for the record here. Yes, Sue, not having read every word of the amendments, do the Dash 2s do what do they satisfy you?
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, Sue Wilson, Health Licensing Office. Yes, these amendments, and I know this was a while back when you heard the bill, actually just make the corrections that weren't complete in the entire piece of legislation. It fixed some citations, as Sandy mentioned. It fixed the environmental health specialist citation the way we wanted it originally. So I did testify to this measure and offered those amendments at that time. And, yes, they meet all of our standards.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Unless I've got all of my materials in the wrong file, didn't we also hear about hearing aid specialists? Isn't that part of this bill?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, yes, there was a name change. Is that what you're referring to? Yes, there was a name change to specialists, from hearing aid dealers to specialists. That isn't part of this amendment. That's part of the entire bill.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Chair would entertain a motion on the Dash 2 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2325.
Representative Westland moves the Dash 2 amendment into House Bill 2325. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
And footnote, this does have a prior reference to Ways and Means.
Representative Westland.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2325 as amended by the Dash 1s to Ways and Means.
Dash 2s.
Dash 2s to Ways and Means.
With
a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Representative Westland moves House Bill 2325 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative, I still have some concerns. Obviously, the Dash amendments are enormous, but about changing the name of hearing aid dealers to hearing aid specialists, I thought there were some good arguments made about that, that it implies that there's a level of education that does not exist. Do we have any more information about that? Or is that just we accept it or we don't?
I don't think it's an education requirement. It's just a...
It's just a name change. Yeah, name that was recommended. I think it's a nationally recognized...
Yeah.
So nationally they're known as hearing aid specialists.
Yes.
They're just the dealers. They don't do the hearing aid testing or any of that. But they just dispense hearing aids. They're still called hearing aid specialists.
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, they actually do in-ear fittings and that sort of... they do provide that service, but there's no change in their education or anything that they have done in over the last 30 years. This is just changing their name to specialist as it relates to kind of the national model of recognition as a term.
So, follow up, please.
Mm-hmm.
So, nationally, that's how they are known as hearing aid specialists. Is that what you're saying? So
yes. Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, yes. Yes.
Conforms with what the rest of the nation does. Thank you, Sue.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Belson.
Excused.
Representative Bonds Anderson.
Aye.
Representative
Tomei.
Aye.
Representative
Westland. Aye. House Bill 2325, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2325. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2939. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2939 modifies current laws relating to the medical use of marijuana. And we have folks here to testify.
Okay. Okay. Representative March and Stormy. Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve March. I represent House District 46 in the center of Portland. And I want to thank you, the chair and the health department, for working on House Bill 2939 and the Dash 1 amendments that are before you. I understand that there may be some changes to the bill to avoid the appearance of expansion of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. But I do want to put on the record that as a gerontologist, I've had experience working with families and caregivers of those patients who suffer from Alzheimer's disease. And agitation in an Alzheimer's patient is one of the stressors that caregivers have to deal with. And it can take many forms, from simply pacing to jerking to even more threatening moves. But so I understand that that might be removed from the bill, but I do want to put on the record that I think it is an appropriate use where a doctor so designates. I also want to put on the record that the Dash 1 amendments both tighten and clarify the laws that are reasonable for the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act cardholders, law enforcement, and the department. And I want to thank you again for your understanding and fairness in preparing the Dash 1 amendments to the bill in its original form. I believe it missed some of the fairness that was intended, and I appreciate the changes being made, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? I think we'll hear a representative from the department that if indeed we do remove that reference, it doesn't change the ability of the department to authorize. So,
thank you. I understand that, and I did want to put on the record that if a doctor prescribes it as an appropriate use, I thought it was appropriate.
Right.
Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you. Stormy, how are you doing?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm doing great.
Good.
I am so glad to be here today and for you guys to be hearing comments, suggestions, recommendations of how to make the Oregon medical marijuana even better. Right now, I think we have the best medical marijuana program in the entire country. But we do have some house cleaning and some tightening up and clarifying that needs to be done. And I appreciate the authors of House Bill 2939 doing this work so that we can all make it work for everybody. Let me begin by stating OMA is the greatest medical marijuana program in the country. And I can see that I have many OMA colleagues here that are prepared to offer their suggestions, and so I'll be brief. I'd like to make three recommendations. The first recommendation, and one of the main messages that I'd like to share with you, is that patients didn't become patients when the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act was passed. Many of us were already ill, sick, and dying when this law came into effect. We all lived with the fear of arrest. Some have been arrested. The provisions that we're going to look at that might make it not possible for a person to be part of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act because they're sick or injured is really kind of cruel, and we're hoping that we can delete that phase of this completely. I will turn in a sheet that has a lot more rational talking than what I'm doing right now, but what I really would like you guys to understand is we truly need your help here today to make this a program that's even better for patients. The second recommendation, let me finish my statement on the first. No patient or caregiver should ever, no Oregonian should ever be barred from being a part of this great program because of a prior offense. And with that, I would truly appreciate your cooperation on that. That's the way the original law was wrote. The second recommendation, this one here is, it has a lot of education behind it, but basically, patients need to be able to keep more of the medicine that we raise. Our harvests only happen every 3 to 4 months. That's a long time for us to try to make what amount is allowed for us to keep last. Many of us are running out before or are choosing not to medicate properly and suffer a little bit more because we know we're going to run out of medicine. So I would ask that this wonderful committee consider deleting the word mature from the sentence in our bill that says that we can have 1 ounce per mature plant. By deleting the word mature, we would be able to keep 1 ounce per plant. Since we're allowed to have 7 plants, that would give me a whole lot better chance of making it from harvest to harvest and still being able to provide myself with the safe medication that I know because I've grown it. My third and last recommendation is because growing our medication is difficult at best, patients need all the help we can get. Just because a harvest is supposed to occur in 3 or 4 months doesn't mean it will. We have infestations and things that happen to our medication that makes the harvest not ever come. And so we're always trying to help each other have the medicine that the patients need. Our caregivers are a vital part of this networking that patients do so that we can have our medication. Caregivers have come out of the woodwork to help us with this program. They have no compensation. It's because of the type of people that they are that they're willing to help us. There's a lot of work involved in making this medication. And I would hope that you would understand that if a patient is well enough to help other patients, then they should be able to be a caregiver for those patients as well. This medicine isn't easy to grow, and it takes a little bit of skill and knowledge, patience, and expense. The other thing is that the spirit of this law, I believe, is cardholders helping cardholders. So please, don't hinder our hands at all. We have a huge hurdle as it is. And as you hear testimony today from my fellow colleagues, OMA colleagues, you'll hear more and more about why this is difficult for us. Please help us make this law even better, not just for patients, not just for officers of the law, which have been fantastic at helping us with this program, but for all Oregonians that may one day need to be on this great program. Thank you.
Thank you. Stormy, did you, I can't remember, did you give us your name for the record when you started?
Did I not?
No, you didn't, but you can do it now. So.
For the record, my name is Stormy Ray.
Thank you very much. And for those who are going to testify, that's just a kind of a little process quirk we have here. So when you come up, you need to give us your name just so the archives have it accurately. So anyway, any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Laird. Good morning.
Don't need that. For the record, my name is Laird Funk. Some of you know that. Many people in this room know that. And for the record, that was Stormy Ray. I've been doing this in this building on this issue specifically since I had the honor of Senator Frank Roberts introducing my Senate Bill 865. If you refer to 865, you will find in there the card, the confidential registry, and a lot less sausage than we see today. I'm proud of the fact that that colonel is still there, and I'm proud of the fact that Stormy Ray is here working on this issue. Halfway through the 97 session, after 500 fruitless trips up and down the House hallways here. I shook hands with Stormy Rain the first time in a rotunda out there. And we had a brief conversation, and I asked her if she was ready to go to work. And she says, as she does, "I am." And we went upstairs, and I introduced her to the first three representatives that I came to. And I knew halfway through that second interview that, by and large, I had just become the silent partner in this question. Anything I've ever had to say on this issue has been made redundant by Stormy Rae. And frankly, some of what I had to say this morning was made redundant by Representative March. And I wish to thank both of them for saving me a lot of time. And you should also. One thing I'd like to do, though, is like we all like to thank each other here a lot. And I know in the years since the passage of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, which was just 2 years after Stormy started taking part in this, and 8 years after I did. There's a clue there. 4,700 people have a card in this state. And I know some of them have thanked Stormy. And I know in the ensuing years of our association, I thanked her personally for a number of things. But I never have thanked her personally for this. So, Stormy, thank you very much. I want to thank this committee. This committee, this last 10 days, would... I think most make Oregonians proud. It's responded, in my estimation, to the Oregon model. I have some fondness for that because I keep referring to my friend Sam McCall, and people keep correcting me that, no, his real name is Tom. And the reality is his name was Sam. He was Tom's rowdy brother. And they shipped him off to Bakersfield, California to teach poli-sci to the dispossessed down there, of which I was one. And he used, every time he had an opportunity over five semesters, to use Oregon as a model. And, well, he should. It's a good model. It's an approachable legislature. People can walk right up here, talk to you face-to-face, talk to your representatives, have you listen, have you respond to concerns, and have things change as a result. I know I spoke to some of you 10 minutes after this bill hit the floor, some of you 10 minutes later, and I kept talking for 10 days, but somewhere in the process, someone said something and things started to change, and I appreciate your response, your concern, and listening with an open heart. You know, I approached this committee kind of as a model of a Well, rephrase that. My approach to committees is based on kind of two models. One is my friendship with Representative Anderson. We used to call him His Honor. At home, we call him Gordon. You know, there's a lot of cliches about how this side of the spectrum politically thinks and how this side of the spectrum politically thinks. And I've written a number of hopefully sufficiently humorous letters about Mr. Anderson to the paper that we've bridged the spectrum gap. And I've learned you never really want to approach someone as if they disagree with you, just because they might disagree about what time the sun comes up. On this issue, I've found disagreement evaporates. I've found staunch conservative members of the Republican caucus say, yes, I truly understand. The same for the other side of the aisle. The other way I approach a committee is it's kind of like you have to make up with your best gal. You just have to put your best out there, tell them what you want to know, want them to know, put your faith in it, pretend Pollyanna lives, and walk out the door. Well, I say both Pollyanna and Sam McCall are proud right now. So before I get too sappy here, I'm just going to kind of leave you with a note that Sam McCall left us. I was hoping, frankly, another friend from home would be in this room and I'd say something nice about him, but I don't see him. But Sam used Oregon legislature as a model, and he told us that Oregonians really, really like their legislators. They elect them repeatedly, and they like them so much they try to keep them home as much as they can. That's because they do like them, and they found that the only time they cause damage is when they group up. He had his brother's sense of humor. I will say to you all, the damage that could have been done by this bill being unmodified was tremendous. The changes you've made have been most helpful and give me hope that some of the other recommendations, and I echo Stormy absolutely, which apparently is my only role. She's already said anything I'd say, so a weak echo as I am. Thank you for your help. Fix the rest of this bill, and let's keep our program going. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, ask them.
I think I would echo one thing, and the only time we are dangerous is when we group up. But Okay. Craig Durbin, Grant Higginson, and Dale Penn. Gentlemen, welcome. However you want to do it.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin. I'm a sergeant with Oregon State Police, and I'm the manager of the Drug Enforcement Section. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2939. The Oregon State Police has worked closely with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, and we believe that this bill will solve several areas that have caused problems and concerns within the program. There have been well-documented cases of individuals within the program who either by lack of education or in an attempt to divert the intent of the program for their own profit have abused the rights granted to them within the program. Oftentimes, law enforcement will inspect a grow site to find either the cardholder or the primary caregiver is over the authorized amounts or is growing for their own profit or is delivering to marijuana to non-cardholders or is participating in other non-authorized activities. Many of these are gross deviations from the program. They oftentimes are people that, and the majority of the people within the program that we have found are attempting to abide by the rules and regulations of the program, but many of these are gross deviations from the program. I do have that I can provide to the committee numerous cases that show these gross deviations that later on these persons are charged for either manufacturing, delivering, possession crimes, and that they have also had previous arrests for those type of offenses. The ability for the program to have the authority to deny or revoke a cardholder's privilege based on potential abuse or known abuse of the program, I think, and the department thinks, is a good step to assure the quality of the program. Cardholders who are in violation of the program do often cite their lack of knowledge or understanding of the rules or regulations as their cause of being outside of those limits. A requirement of cardholders to show their understanding of all the rules and regulations of the program, as described in the proposed amendments, will allow the program to assess their efforts in informing all cardholders of responsibilities under this program. This will also protect cardholders from potential criminal penalties for being outside the limits of those programs. And that's a concern we do have, is the protection of them to make sure that they do understand. Oftentimes when we do contact these people, they're being told by outside resources or groups that they can grow a certain amount of plants or that they can do certain things that are not within the rules and regulations of the program. This continues to be an evolving program, and these proposed changes will be a step to keep up with these new issues as they come to light. This concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Thank you.
For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, State Public Health Department with the Department of Human Services, and I, too, would like to thank the committee and you, Chair Cruz, for hearing this bill today. We are in support of a number of the provisions in House Bill 2939. We found out about the ONEA wanting to sponsor this bill and asked if we could add a number of provisions that we wanted to see happen. And the ONEA was gracious enough to let us tag along on this bill, and I wanted to thank them for that. As you know, the Medical Marijuana Act was originally passed in November of 1998. It was a ballot initiative. It was not a health division initiative by any means. We, however, in that act, were given a couple of responsibilities, and our responsibility is to administer those provisions. And so we try to stay neutral when we're looking at the act. We try to make sure that there is a balance that we provide in making sure that we are providing good customer service to the clients that are registered and qualify for the program. On the other hand, we feel that we have a responsibility to help protect against any potential abuses. The program has been in operation for almost 4 years now, and over that period of time, there have been a number of what I would call programmatic or administrative problems that have come up. And so what we wanted to do with our provisions of the bill is try to correct some of those problems. The first issue was really just a house cleaning issue. Our main responsibility in the Act is to have this registration system for qualified patients, but another provision is to have a process where any citizen may petition to add an additional condition to the list of debilitating medical conditions that were in the original law. In the first year of operation, we received requests from petitioners to add 8 new positions. All of them were mental health related positions. What we did then was pulled together what we considered to be a blue ribbon panel of scientists, epidemiologists, health professionals to look at those 8 conditions. There was consensus on none of them, but where we had the most agreement was in the area of agitation for Alzheimer's disease. And so consequently, in the year 2000, by administrative rule, we added that as the only one of those 8 conditions that would be added to the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. Our attempt in including this in the original bill was just to clean up and codify the fact that we've already, by rule, made this change, and Alzheimer's agitation is now one of the debilitating medical conditions. If the committee, as I've heard being suggested, chooses not to put that in the law, it would not affect the way that we run the program or the list of conditions that we currently have. The second issue deals with physicians and our relationship to physicians and their relationship to the program. At the current time, if a attending physician notifies us that they believe that the patient no longer qualifies for the program, either they no longer have the debilitating medical condition or that there is now some contraindication for their use of medical marijuana, there is nothing that the program can do in the way of revoking that patient's card. Consequently, that's something that we need to believe that we need to clear up. We also have experienced cases where we have received notification from a physician that a particular patient is no longer qualified for the program, and then find out after that person card has expired that they are attempting to get another card from a different attending physician. We believe that if that is the case, that the new attending physician deserves to know the thought process that went behind the original attending physician's reason for recommending the person not be a part of the program. Consequently, we feel that that information should be shared in the hopes of stopping any inappropriate doctor shopping. And then the third issue around attending physicians is that occasionally when we are seeing a renewal, and the patients who are on the registration program have to renew on a yearly basis, when we see a renewal, we get from the physician when we send back for a verification that this is indeed that a patient of that physician, we hear from the physician that they had no idea why the patient had asked them for this information. They had no idea that the patient was going to use this as a way to renew their medical marijuana application, and consequently we would like to see that upon renewal that physicians also once again recognize that the patient has a qualifying condition and they may benefit from the use of medical marijuana. And then the third issue that we wanted to see in was the ability for us to revoke a card due to past criminal offenses. We have, again, on a number of occasions received from law enforcement or from the justice system questions as to why we have approved a card when this person has a chronic pattern of numerous drug-related offenses. And at the current time, we have no authority to revoke a card or not provide a card due to that reason, and consequently we thought that we needed to have that kind of authority. So that was the testimony that I had on the actual bill itself, and before we open up any questions, I would also like to speak to the amendments, which I had some part in putting together, and which I do think provide substantial improvements to some of the issues. The first amendment is the one that is dealing with a educational program. As it was originally written, I thought that really we were becoming a DMV for the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, that we would have to provide materials and testing and certify the testing had been done. I think that is onerous to the patients. I also think that it would be a huge administrative burden for the program as well. And so what we would propose here is a much simpler solution, that we provide educational materials. Of course, people can also read the law themselves, but then when they are completing the application form, one of the pieces would be a signed statement saying that they have read information about the act and understand it, that they understand you cannot drive while under the influence, you cannot smoke in a public place, that it does not exempt you from other criminal activities, including providing marijuana to unauthorized patients. So that we thought was a simpler and more appropriate solution. The second two amendments are adding simply... The second two amendments are simply adding that when a physician is informing us of the fact that a patient may not qualify any longer for the act, that they inform the patient as well. And again, I think that this is only good practice. On the
question, Mr. Chair, yes, question. No. Thank you, Grant. Tell me what materials you're referring to. That would help me follow along.
I'm trying to refer to the -1 amendments.
Okay, but you're not referring to either of these two materials that you gave us earlier. One dated the 21st and
no.
The 18th. So you're just referring to the -1.
Chair, could Representative told me that's correct. I was referring to these, and actually I was cross-referencing some stuff on those materials. But
thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you also have a hand-engrossed bill with the -1s, and that would probably be easier for you to follow as we discuss it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So tell me where you are, Grant, please.
Okay. Do you have a copy of the bill? No, I can't find my copy of the bill. And would you like to start over with
no,
this?
No,
is, okay.
No.
Where?
I think you're on page 2A of the hand engrossed, talking about the educational materials. Let me. There you go.
Okay, I've got it here. Thank you.
Okay, yes, on page 2A, where we're talking about the new educational program, it now says a signed statement that the person has read educational materials about the medical use of marijuana and has read the statute and understands the legal requirements for the use of this medical marijuana. And then it provides that the department will provide these educational materials in a written form and our website, and we'll think of other ways to get that information out to people as well, and we'll certainly use advocacy groups to do that.
Okay. Representative Mona Sanderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Higginson, what if there's a patient who is bedridden and is unable to really access a computer or read? I'm thinking of a patient that had pancreatic cancer, and medical marijuana was the only way to get rid of her nausea and her and being able to keep food down. Are there exceptions in that case regarding someone who maybe is so debilitated they're not able to really do the education piece?
All right, Chair Cruz, Representative Mona Sanderson, I would assume that even in that condition, that the primary caregiver would be a person that could be reviewing those materials and going over that with the patient to get that to comply with that part of the law. The next amendment. And this is on page 4. starting with line 31. And this is in the case where a physician has decided that the patient no longer qualifies for the program. There are two amendments, one in line 31 and one in line 34, simply stating that the physician has a responsibility to inform the patient as well as informing the program. And again, I think that that is a very reasonable provision for and good medical practice. The next amendment starts on, again, page 4, line 37. So after a physician has decided a patient is no longer qualified and notified us, originally the bill read that within 7 days that we were to provide them to the registrant notification that they were no longer on the program. And we believe that it would be reasonable for the patient at that time to get a second opinion and consequently have modified that language so that it now says no sooner than 45 days but no later than 60 days. So in that few week window of time, we would notify the patient. So then they have already been notified by their physician that they are going to be removed from the program. If they can find another physician that says they still need to be on, then their card would not be revoked. And that is addressed on page 5. Actually, I'm having a hard time seeing where it is now in the gross version, but what it says is notwithstanding paragraph C of the subsection, if the person does provide to the department the valid written documentation from a different attending physician prior to receiving the notice of revocation, then the person registration remains valid. The next amendment is on page 5. Line 9, and it is stating that information about the person's grow site that is provided to the department under the section is confidential and may not be disclosed except to employees of law enforcement agencies as necessary to verify the site is registered with the department. And that simply says that the grow site information that's now being required in the law is held as confidential as the rest of the information that we have, but that we continue to be able to share that information when verification is needed with law enforcement agencies. The next provision is, again, on page 5, line 34. And it used to read, the department shall permanently revoke the registry and identification card of a person who's been convicted of a drug-related felony. And particularly with the suggestions from Representative March, we felt that there may be conditions when it would be appropriate for a felon still to be able to use medical marijuana. Similarly, felon who has committed drug-related offenses is not precluded from using other narcotics if indeed it is found that that would benefit the patient. And so what we are suggesting is to change shall to may so that we have the authority to revoke a card if we believe that's appropriate, but it also gives us the authority to work with the patient, the healthcare provider, whoever is in the adjustment or law enforcement system that might also be involved, to come up with arrangements where that person may still have access to medical marijuana.
Representative Morris Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the wording then would prevent a discriminatory medical practice issue then. Is that correct? Is that why this was changed?
Chair Cruz, Representative Morris Anderson, that is the intent of the amendment. That is absolutely correct. The next amendment is on page 6. And it used to read that any patient who was on the registration could not serve as a primary caregiver to another patient. And I think it is appropriate when a patient is debilitated to such a condition that they do need to have a primary caregiver, that it's reasonable to assume that that patient cannot be a caregiver to somebody else. But for a patient who does not have a primary caregiver, a patient who is able to care for themselves and to grow or procure their own medical marijuana, that patient may indeed be a good person to be a primary caregiver for another patient. And consequently, we have in our amendment, suggested amendment, softened that language, and I hope anyway that it's addressing the issue that Stormy Ray brought up when she was testifying.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we have two AIDS patients, which has been the case in my practice, and they're both users of medical marijuana, does this preclude one of them from being designated the caregiver?
Chair Cruz, Representative Moses Anderson, no, it does not, as long as one of them does not have a primary caregiver. So assuming that one of them was extremely ill and the other one was in much more lesser advanced state of that disease and was still feeling pretty well and was able to provide their own care and grow the medical marijuana, then that patient could be a primary caregiver for the more ill patient. However, if they both got to a point where they were both so severely debilitated that they could no longer provide those services and had to have a primary caregiver for each of those patients, at that point, neither of those patients could be a primary giver for somebody else.
Question, Mr. Chair. Why is that sentence necessary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I'm not sure exactly what the question is.
Well, if I read the sentence, a person who has been issued a registry identification card and has a designated primary caregiver may not serve as a designated primary caregiver. For what purpose is that sentence in there?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, the purpose that we saw was trying to keep, again, the intent of the law as we read it. And as we see it, when you look at the definition of a primary caregiver, which is someone who is responsible for more than just providing marijuana, but for the day-to-day, I should look up the exact language. But the primary caregiver has significant responsibility for managing the well-being of a person who has been diagnosed with a debilitating medical condition. The way that we read that is that is someone more than simply providing medical marijuana, but really involved in the care of that patient. Well, if you need to have a primary caregiver because you are debilitated to the extent that you cannot provide those services for yourself, then it's difficult for us to understand how you then could be a primary caregiver for somebody else. So the purpose of that amendment really is to try to keep it in line with what we see as the intent of the law.
Thank you.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Sort of on that, a paraplegic in most cases requires two caregivers in order to move them from bed to tub and et cetera. That doesn't preclude that. You'll always have to then have a designated primary care, and, I mean, you couldn't have two primary care.
Chair Cruz, Representative Mona Sanderson, my understanding, the way the bill reads now, is that you can have one and only one designated primary caregiver. And that has been an issue that has come up, that's been raised by the advocates, but that is not something that's been addressed before in the law or in these amendments.
So you have a primary caregiver that's working 12 hours, and then another primary caregiver comes to work the next shift. I mean, that's the kind of scenario I'm thinking of. But I guess I need to know what the definition of primary caregiver is.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Bone Sanderson, there is nothing that would preclude a number of caregivers for assisting in the care of a patient with that is using medical marijuana, but the designated primary caregiver is an additional individual who is exempted from civil and criminal laws of the state for possessing, delivering, helping with the administration of medical marijuana. And at least right now, the statute reads that there can only be one of those persons for any individual case.
I don't know. There might be a conflict, but I would think that the patients, you just designate one of them and the other would be a helper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And then the final amendment is to put an emergency clause on the bill, and because this is administrative problems that we've seen on an ongoing basis, we would like to be able to implement them sooner rather than later. And with that, I'll stop and be happy to answer any questions.
Any other questions? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Little one, and this was from an email that I had where they were concerned regarding a patient who is in a correctional facility. And I'm afraid I don't know where it is in this piece, but it says that their concern was you can have high blood pressure medicine in jail, but then in certain cases you wouldn't be able to have marijuana in the jail. Do you know, would that have been referring to the drug having a felony?
Chair Cruz, Representative Mona Sanderson, I can see people who are incarcerated for non-drug-related felonies that would be on the medical marijuana program, and our position on questions like that has always been that it's up to the institution to work with their own legal counsel to figure out, you know, what are the rights of the individual. But as a program, we really can't answer that one.
Yeah, I think Dale would be probably more appropriate to answer that one. So, and he's next.
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Dale Penn. I'm representing the District Attorney's Association. I'm Marion County District Attorney, and Kevin Campbell from Chiefs of Police Association is here today, but since he's faking that he doesn't have a voice, I'm speaking for him today in testimony.
Any time a Campbell can't talk, it's
sure is a god in heaven.
But if I might address just the last question, that issue is not really addressed in the bill. It was an issue that I did participate in 4 years ago in a work group with the ACLU and law enforcement and others, and there was a bill that went forward and was passed, and it did have some modifications to the ballot measure to make it clearer for law enforcement, for people utilizing medical marijuana, for the health division about how to administer this. One of those modifications was the concept that medical marijuana was not something that would be utilized in correctional facilities. And there are a lot of reasons for it. First of all, there are alternative treatments, and there's a lot of discussion about there can be alternative treatments than the use and smoking of marijuana. But in a correctional facility, however, marijuana is a very prized possession. It is a very difficult situation for control of a facility. The sale and use of narcotics is something that goes on no matter how much enforcement and attempt there is to control that use within prison environments. But the idea of having some state-controlled use of marijuana within the Oregon State Penitentiary was something that was totally unmanageable. And so that was part of the modification 4 years ago. It is not part or suggested to be changed in this statute, but that was the reason. We do have people beaten up. We have drug debts, killings. Unfortunately, it occurs in the correctional facility. We believe this would contribute to that problem that's already present.
Thank you.
I'd simply say very quickly then, for the Chiefs of Police and for the DA's Association, we are strongly supportive of the Dash 1 amendments in the bill as it's presented to you. I know you've heard a little bit of testimony, and Dr. Higginson talked about the need to have at least some discretion when criminal abuse and convictions becomes an issue, we think the word may revoke or may permanently revoke kind of deals with both issues. It doesn't prohibit someone who has prior record from utilizing medical marijuana, but it does give the division the ability to revoke an abuser of the statute. And I think that is important and is necessary. We are strongly supportive of the Dash 1 amendments in the bill. There is one issue that we do have that we would like to see addressed. And in the work group that I spoke of, if you've been following the Dash 1 amendments, the Hand and Gross amendments on what's identified as page 5, I'll just highlight for you in ORS 475.316. In present law, there is a sub E, one sub E, and one sub F. And what we were attempting to get at, and this was part of the modification in our work group that came forward, was we were very concerned about having someone be a caregiver for 30 patients and having marijuana fields and how that was going to be a very difficult law enforcement problem. So the intent with E and F was to confine the grow operations to one grow at each location, so no more than 7 plants growing at one location, so that we don't have someone with, you know, a 200 plant indoor grow or outdoor grows with fields. The proposal here that we believe needs to be modified, because we do not believe that the language in lines 27 and 28, that producing just at the location given to the Department of Human Services, we think there needs to be a little tweaking there to make sure that we can prevent the huge grow operation that we believe will be a very difficult problem. But we're prepared to suggest some language for that, and other than that, we believe these are good modifications that will continue to help prevent abuse but allow the intent of the statute to move forward.
Questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much, and thanks for the explanation of the Dash 1s. Let's go down with this, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so. I don't know who that guy walked up behind that.
Just a resource. Hal Ballard? Good morning, and I would also ask, we have a lot of folks signed up here, and I would ask that I don't want to cut anybody down, but I ask you to be concise and try to not reiterate what other folks have said, just because I want everybody to have a chance to say their piece today.
Thank you, Chair Cruz, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you. My name is Hal Ballard, for the record. I'm with Voter Power Foundation in Portland and also the Life with Dignity Committee. When I wrote my testimony that is being handed before you last night, I hadn't had opportunity to read the amendments. In the beginning line of my written testimony says, this bill is mean-spirited and does nothing to help patients, regardless of their past, to get effective medicine for their ailments. And then as I read the amendments, I did find one good thing in it, and that was on page one, the addition of the agitation due to Alzheimer's. I thought that was already part of it, the law already, but other than that, what I wanted to say was that in 1974, I was convicted for maintaining an establishment where marijuana was being sold. It was my house. I paid the rent. I was convicted, served 3 years on probation. But that's only part of it. I have a 74-year-old patient who is in the last stages of his chemotherapy treatment. The chocolate chip can of butter cookies that I make for him serve three purposes. They reduce the nausea from his treatments, they stimulate his appetite to eat other foods, and I get to feel better because a simple thing like making cookies for an old man improves his quality of life. I have another patient, a woman who suffers from Crohn's disease and fibromyalgia in addition to other disorders. I grind medical marijuana and put it in capsules, and she uses them to reduce the intestinal cramping from the Crohn's and the extreme pain, tenderness, stiffness of muscles, etc. from the fibromyalgia. A third patient is my 30-year-old son. Due to an automobile accident many years ago, he has more metal in him than some of the cars on the road today. He receives acupuncture, acupressure, chiropractic treatment. But the medicine that best causes his muscles to relax and allows him to sleep is by smoking some marijuana before he goes to bed. This bill would not only affect these three patients, but hundreds and thousands of others, because, fact of the matter is, the best growers are usually those who have done it for a long time, and many are likely, like myself, to have had some run-in with the law. These caregivers are trusted and supported by their patients because it is certainly no easy task to grow a plant that can reach tree-like proportions in a spare bedroom or closet. We won't go into trying to provide room for three such patients per plant as it is under the current law. Many of us before you here are in our 50s and 60s and older. I want to hold my grandson. I want to take him for a bike ride. Some of us just want to get an appetite. None of us are rich. Few of us have adequate health care, and we all regret the mistakes of the past. Your bill, in effect, would recriminalize us. The current law as written allows me as a registered patient to serve as a designated primary caregiver. And like your question, Representative Manas Anderson, why is this a problem? No, I'm sorry, it was Representative Tomei. Why is it a problem? I don't understand it. That's all. I'll take any questions.
Any questions, Mr. Ballard? Thank you very much, Mr. Ballard.
You are.
Larry Welty, please. Identify yourself, please.
Good morning. I'm Larry Welty with the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association. I'm the president. I retired in November. I was the commander of the Drug Enforcement Section of the Oregon State Police. As Grant Higginson had said, we did draft the bill in conjunction with working with the Health Division and others. It is very important to understand that I would say 8 years ago, I probably wouldn't have made this statement because I wasn't as familiar with the medical marijuana use as I am today, but some people would probably be shocked that I am not opposed to medical marijuana use, but I am opposed to the abuses within the system that can potentially eliminate a program that does assist people. And so, having said that, I think it's very important to allow the Health Division to take a look at somebody's criminal history related to the manufacture and distribution of marijuana illegally, and make a determination based on that individual's record whether or not they could be in particular a care provider for another individual. Because while I was the commander, I had a number of cases that came in my office that either a patient or a care provider would have large excesses, and there would be evidence of sales, and it was apparent to me that the only reason that they were in the program was so they could somehow legitimately produce marijuana, but at the same time they're providing marijuana illegally to other individuals for their own personal gain. And this has happened. And I'm not saying that the majority of the people are doing this, but the majority of the people that are arrested that are involved in this do have prior criminal histories associated to this. So it shows a propensity for them to continue this criminal activity. And just as an example, we had one individual in Lane County had 200 plants and was providing their own care. They were a patient, and there was large sales going on. This individual is very good at manufacturing marijuana, and just in case you're not aware, plants are capable of producing several ounces, up to a pound per plant. So we're not talking about something that can only produce an ounce or two. Now, if they don't know what they're doing, yes, they are going to have a difficult time producing those. But somebody that has been convicted of manufacturing marijuana before, I guarantee you, knows how to grow marijuana and can produce large quantities of marijuana. So it's important to let the health division take a look at that and make a determination. Obviously, if somebody was convicted, say, 5 or 10 years ago for manufacturing five marijuana plants or something like that, and there was no indication of sales, that the health division would look at that less strongly than somebody that was convicted a year ago of growing 200 plants and had 100 pounds of marijuana at the location and a long list of sales records. And so that's what we wanted to give them the ability to look at. So with that, I'll conclude.
Any questions?
Madam Chair, could you tell me how many violations you would estimate may have occurred, say, in the last year?
We just put together a list of about 50 of them. Actually, there's been more than that, closer to probably, and again, this was over the last 4 years, you said?
The last year.
Within the last year, I couldn't tell you right now, but I could get back to you with that.
Divide 50 by 4? Be reasonable? 10 a year?
No, it's more than that, much more than that.
And how many medical card holders are there, would you say?
I heard testimony earlier, it's about 4,700.
Okay. Roughly that's accurate.
Yes.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Leland Burger?
Mr. Burger? Is it Leland?
Yes. Good morning.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Leland Burger. I'm a lawyer. My bar number is 83020. That means next month I will have been practicing law for 20 years. I practice from my home in northeast Portland in Representative Kefouri's district, but my practice is statewide. I looked at a list of counties last night, and I've represented patients or caregivers in one aspect or another, ranging from suing to because the state police refused to return medical marijuana, to dealing, filing declaratory judgments on behalf of patients relating to the the program's interpretation of the Medical Marijuana Act. Currently, for example, I represent a patient in Josephine County where the district attorney has taken a position different from anybody else in the state, that the fact that a patient has an attending physician saying that the patient needs 14 plants doesn't establish the affirmative defense that was created in the 99 legislature that allows excessive quantities if, in the opinion of the attending physician, it's medically necessary. And this week I was in Lincoln County on a case where a patient is cultivating an excessive number of plants because it's medically necessary for him to do so, because he extracts the oil and puts it into capsules and uses that to be able to fall asleep. And yesterday I was in McMinnville where the district attorney woke up one morning and decided that no patient could be on probation and that any patient who was going to be violated as a consequence. And I helped draft the Medical Marijuana Act. I testified against the amendments in 1999. I'm here today to testify against these amendments, although not in total. It's not as bad as it could be, and there are parts of it that are, you know, would be acceptable. But overall, it's there. In the first place, there is no emergency, and they're just not necessary. Additionally, I can tell you, that I am a co-founder of Voter Power, the group that provided grassroots support for the initiative in 1998. I serve as legal counsel to that organization. I've provided legal advice to Oregon Normal and Portland Normal before it became Oregon Normal, to Mothers Against Misuse and Abuse, and I serve on the board of advisors of the Eugene Compassion Club. And so I'm very active on this issue, and I'm one of the activists in the state that have been meeting with Dr. Higginson and Mary Leverett, the current acting program director. And I'd really like to see this list Larry Welty says exists, because there aren't abuses under the Act as far as I'm aware of. My representation of patients is, you know, from up and down the I-5 corridor and out to Hood River and on the coast from Lincoln County south, and I have a client in Deschutes County and a client in Baker County, but so I don't know about all the cases. I haven't ever heard of this 200 plant case, and when the state police speak about well-documented cases of abuse, that is contrary to my experience, and I don't like to tell anyone, whether it's a judge in a courtroom or a jury in a courtroom or a legislative panel of a committee of the legislature, that law enforcement is purposefully deceiving you. And the only way I can try and rationalize it is that, for example, this guy represented in Baker had about 20 plants. He was thinning down to 6 plants, 3 mature plants for himself and 3 mature plants for the other patient he was a caregiver for. The state police probably view that as an abuse of the act, but of the 17 plants, 7 were males, which don't produce therapeutic cannabis, which is what medical marijuana is more appropriately called, and were seized from the compost pile. So, which is to say that what I find in my practice is that patients and caregivers who run afoul of the law, who are arrested and who are prosecuted, are for the most part trying hard to comply with the law, and that there aren't the kinds of documented abuses that either of the police officers testified to today. So what kind of people have prior convictions? There's two kinds. One is that before the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act passed, and really the reason why I got involved in it, is that medical marijuana patients, and not just under the definition of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, where you have a list of documented debilitating medical condition, and your physician thinks it's medically appropriate for you to use, but under a much tougher standard that it's medically necessary, that there's no other medicine that's as efficacious, or if it is, the side effects are intolerable. Patients were precluded from presenting that defense in court when they were criminally prosecuted. And that preclusion of being able to present that defense was upheld by our Court of Appeals in a case, State versus Owenby, O-W-N-B-E-Y. I don't have the citation for you, but you could find it pretty easily, I think. And as has already been testified to, Mr. Ballard and elsewhere, either... And by Stormy Ray, for that matter, I want to echo her comments that patients aren't... The idea of the Medical Marijuana Act was to make patients who were previously illegal, who didn't have the right to present a defense in court, who were subject to arrest and prosecution and forfeiture, free from that. And that presupposes that there were a group of patients who were, prior to the passing of the law, patients. Some of those patients were arrested, some of them were prosecuted, and some of them were convicted. And it's inappropriate to deny those people medication, especially where some of these patients fit the more stringent test of it being medically necessary, of there not being other medicine that's as efficacious, or if it is, the side effects are intolerable. There are a lot of people who don't choose medical marijuana because they want to get stoned. In fact, patients tell me regularly that patients who had used previously, which is recreationally, which is not all patients, but they tell me regularly that when they use, that they don't get that effect when they use medicinally. And then the other group is the care providers. And I have to say that Dr. Higginson misrepresented the state of the law relating to a primary caregiver. It is a person who's substantially responsible for the care and well-being of a patient, and as to providing them medical marijuana, or therapeutic cannabis, as it's more appropriately called, that's what the designated primary caregiver does. Now, I'm 47 years old. I went to college. I'm not a medical marijuana patient, but I have smoked marijuana. I have used cannabis recreationally to enhance different sensory experiences, including music and art and nature and whatnot, over the years. But I forgot where I was going. I'm sorry. You guys,
that was good. That was good.
The I did forget where I was going.
Well, you've forgotten, Mr. Berger. May I come up with a question?
Sure. Oh, I do remember now.
All right.
I've never grown marijuana, Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, but I have, since I've been defending patients over the last 4 years, seen a lot of gardens. I've seen scrawny little plants grown indoors under lights. I've seen scrawny little plants grown outdoors. I've seen Christmas trees outdoors, and I've seen, you know, Christmas tree-sized medical marijuana plants under two lights indoors. Growing marijuana is not tomatoes, but it's not rocket science either, but it is somewhere in the middle. There's skill involved in it. Now, people who know how to cultivate therapeutic-grade cannabis have cultivated it. Some of them have cultivated it since before the passage of the Act. Some of them never got caught at doing it. Others were. A law that would allow the health department to preclude a registration card as a caregiver, designated primary caregiver, to a person who had a prior conviction would deny therapeutic cannabis medicine to patients, and it's wrong. Our history with the health department where they're given discretion about what to do, because under current law, they under their current rules, they can suspend the card of a patient who gets convicted of a crime, and they have discretion about doing that, and every time, every single time they've been notified about it, they've done that. The Oregon Supreme Court has said, with reference to the exercise of discretion as it applies to equal protection sorts of challenges, and under State versus Freeland and its progeny, that that a decision to treat everything the same is the exercise of discretion and doesn't violate the Equal Protection Clause. So the concern that I have is that if you pass this bill as amended, setting out the giving the department the authority to deny a card to a patient or their designated primary caregiver, I'm looking at page 5 where the dash 1 gross amendment changes shall to may in terms of permanently revoke, and also on page 1 page 3 at lines 31 that they'll exercise it every time. There are over 4,700 patients who are registered currently under the Act, and about a third of them have designated a primary caregiver. And for the benefit of the committee, I want to explain how that part of the law works, since there was some confusion about it in prior testimony. The way we drafted the law in 1998, the enabled a patient to cultivate for him or herself, or if the patient were unable to, then the patient could designate a person to do that for them. That's what a designated primary caregiver does. And about a third of the registered patients have designated primary caregivers. That means that currently in Oregon, there's roughly 5,500 people who are either cultivating or delivering or using therapeutic cannabis as medical marijuana. One thing that you never hear from law enforcement is, what that means in dollars and cents. And if you figure that each patient or a patient's caregiver cultivates three mature plants, and they can do that three times a year, and under the DEA standard, each plant can yield a pound, and if a pound is worth $4,000 in the black market or the underground market, that means that under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, $250 million, a quarter of $1 billion, has been removed from the black market as a result of the Medical Marijuana Act. When Dr. Higginson speaks about this multiple caregiver thing, here's what that's about. The law is that a person can, if a person registers with the health department, that they're exempt from arrest or prosecution or forfeiture so long as they abide by the conditions of the act. Among other preclusions are selling or using in public or private. We read that to mean that any cardholder, any patient, any caregiver can deliver less than 1 ounce of marijuana to any other patient or caregiver. The health department, in denying a program that we'd set up for a guy who's paralyzed from the neck down, a guy as a result of a drunk driver car accident in Florence about 10 or 12 years ago, whose therapeutic use of cannabis reduces his reliance on morphine from 300 milligrams a day to 35 milligrams a day, where we had worked up a situation where he was going to have different people bringing him this, other cardholders, bringing him these muffins that he eats. They said, no, you can't do that because that means there's multiple caregivers. It doesn't mean there are multiple caregivers. At the 1999 hearing on the bill that passed then, Dale Penn spoke about, the record will show that Dale Penn spoke about, in response to a question about where a patient's going to get medicine and plants from, that patients would be allowed to share, and we believe that currently is the law. Turning specifically to the proposed changes, Dr. Higginson did accurately describe to you about the procedure, which unfortunately only yielded an expansion to include agitation due to Alzheimer's disease. The department has promulgated a rule that's added that to the list, and as a legal matter, you should rely on legislative counsel, but I don't know that a statutory change is required to effectuate that. If a patient has addled Alzheimer's disease or agitation due to Alzheimer's and his physician or her physician indicates in writing that there's person's been diagnosed with that and that marijuana might mitigate that, and they pay $150, the department will issue them a card, I think, under current law. The grow site issue, in terms of the definition part of things, is not a problem. On page 2A, which amends the bottom of page 2, section F, concerning this education thing, here's the problem. They're asking for a signed statement that the patient or designated primary caregiver understands the legal requirements for medical use of marijuana. Chair Cruz, members of the committee, I'm letting you know that the law is ambiguous in many ways, that there are 36 elected district attorneys who are the chief law enforcement officers for their respective counties, and they are interpreting the law in different ways, and that the only reason to include this kind of language is to, if a person is accused of violating the law because they misunderstood what the provision was, is they can be told in court, well, you signed a paper that said you understood it. So it's to defeat that kind of a defense, which they then in turn want to use to deny the person medication. I've already spoken to the proposed changes on page 3 at line 31 and at line 37. And why those are inappropriate. The proposed changes on page 4, I had spoken with Mary Leverett, who's the acting program manager, some time ago, and I said, Mary, is there some thing that the advocates and the program can work on together to present to the legislature that would be appropriate to change the law? And Mary said, well, sometimes physicians say that, you know, they don't really want their patient using this anymore, because the law already is that if the condition stops, the patient's required to notify the division and return their card within 7 days. But she says, you know, sometimes physicians change their mind about it, really for whatever reason. I mean, it could be because the patient's not paying the bill, because most of the patients are indigent. It could be because they're afraid of the federal government, because of the federal government's activities in California. It could be for a host of reasons, but she says she gets calls from these people and she doesn't have anything to do. How can we fix it? And I said, you mean to say that in the 4 years since the law passed, the only change that you can propose is giving you the ability to revoke a person's card, and that the public health is best served by having that patient being exposed to arrest and prosecution and forfeiture? And she said, oh, Lee, you always turn everything around. But the bottom line is that the act is about protecting patients from law enforcement. And under the current regime in the program, what the legislature gets is a bill where the program acts in collusion with law enforcement about abuses that don't exist, to use another analogy, to give really weapons of mass destruction to them, to allow the wholesale denial of patients' cards if there's a conviction. What we really need in the program is regime change. But on page 4A, they try to ameliorate the problem about this, and I don't know that this is constitutional, frankly, requiring that the patients providing them this information is before the notice of the revocation under State versus Thule and other cases that or DMV relating to DMV suspensions. I don't think a pre-revocation requirement on the patient pre-revocation cuts it. I don't have a problem particularly with the change on page 5 about providing the gross out information only to law enforcement. But I do want to speak to the proposed change on lines 27 and 28. Produces marijuana at a location other than the grow site reported to the Department of Human Services. Dale Penn accurately told you that subsections E and F were introduced in 1999 at the request of law enforcement as a part of a work group that included others, but the genesis of it really is their request, and it really is for the reason that he stated. I mean, when the law first passed, I got calls from people, since you can be a caregiver for an unlimited number of patients, can I, you know, have 10 patients and grow 70 plants. And different communities have dealt with it differently. Ed Glick is here, and he can tell you about the experience in Benton County, where the sheriff's office said that you could have 3 patients and 21 plants. But it really varies county to county, and for the most part, as long as it's kept relatively low in number, we haven't had any problems with law enforcement. We have had a problem in Douglas County. A patient in Douglas County, who is a patient for himself, or a caregiver for himself and his wife and 5 other people, had the other problem that patients and caregivers have besides interference from law enforcement, which is that therapeutic cannabis, medical marijuana, was stolen from his barn and by a burglar who came into his barn and took it and was caught in the next county, actually, and he was a felon, the burglar. And when the patient reported this to the sheriff in Douglas County, the sheriff said, well, you know, I don't know that you want to report this, because the district attorney in Douglas County, he takes the position that you can be a caregiver for as many people as you want, but you can only cultivate, I didn't bring my code with me, but I think it's 475306, as if you were cultivating only for one patient at your home. And that, I think, is what law enforcement is trying to achieve with this bill, and it's inappropriate. It's contrary to the intent of the law, and I mean, you've heard from Stormy, and you'll hear from other patients today, I'm sure, that the biggest problem really with the law is that there's no mechanism for distribution other than where we have a dispute with the health department about, or with Dr. Higginson, about whether patients and caregivers can freely share. I just have a few other things, and then I'd be glad to answer any other questions that you might have. The answer to the question about why a person who's been issued a registry identification card and has a primary caregiver can't also serve as a designated primary caregiver is that because law enforcement doesn't want it, and they want to deny patients medicine, and they want to, and that's where they are on it. And again, there isn't any emergency. I did want to check my notes if I could. The legislature in 1999 precluded a medical marijuana patient who has a card, who's been sentenced to a correctional facility or to a youth authority center from having medical marijuana. Whether that violates constitutional prescriptions against cruel and unusual punishment has not been litigated. But the fact is that it is the only medicine, as far as I know, that's being denied patients who are in people who are in prison. Those are all that I have, unless there's any question. I mean, the other concern I have, and I wanted to let you know, Representative Westland, is that I represent currently a patient in Deschutes County whose renewal was denied because of a conviction. Do you have that? Which predates the, where the act predates the initial application. I spoke with Dr. Higginson. He said that his understanding of the law is the same as mine, and that shouldn't have happened, and I'm working to correct that. But again, those are the kinds of problems that we're seeing under the act. And several of us, frankly, worked on identifying, you know, what the problems were. The fees too high, patients can't find physicians, and we drafted a new initiative, the OMA2. It's been filed with the Secretary of State. It's been designated initiative number 31. It's available on their website. John Sajo, who's the director of Voter Power, and I filed comments, and I've been speaking with Erica Hadlock, who's the Assistant Attorney General who's drafting the ballot title. We'll have a final ballot title on Wednesday. But if the committee is interested in amending the medical marijuana law in a way that helps patients, what I'd encourage you to do is to delete these amendments entirely and insert instead the OMA 2. What the OMA 2, the centerpiece of the OMA 2 is that it would create a third level of person who's protected. In addition to patients and caregivers, it would create licensed and regulated dispensaries, which would fund the program and be required to provide a certain amount of the medicine to indigent patients. We think that this is constitutional under the Ninth and Tenth Amendments and under a states' rights analysis, that the federal government wouldn't be able to interfere with this. But and we had polled on it about a year ago, and 81% of Oregonians who were registered voters and likely to vote supported it. Across all, I forget what you call them now. Across all demographic boundaries, party affiliation or age. Or, in fact, we had originally polled on a legalization constitutional amendment, and 50% of the people opposed that. 70% of the 50% who oppose legalization support the creation of dispensaries. So not only would it be a good idea for patients if this committee were to gut and stuff this bill with the medical, with the OMA 2, it would be popular with your constituents. Thank you very much for this time. Again, I'd be willing to answer any other questions you have.
Any questions? Representative Barker.
When you said that you're not seeing the abuse, I was in the program, and I was abusing it, and had a major growth that I was selling. I probably wouldn't come to you, would I?
You would, in the sense that, well, let me give you an example. I represent a guy currently in Gresham, and he had about 50 plants, and he was selling medical marijuana. He was also giving away plants. He was selling it only to patients, and he lost money at it. So, you know, it's not appropriate for him to do that, but it's also not appropriate that he shouldn't be able to use medicinally once he's convicted for the sales part of it.
That is, my question was more, you were saying you don't see abuses, and what I'm saying is I would suspect there are abuses, that, and those people would not come to you because you're not in the line of defending that kind of, I mean, you're taking care of patients.
Patients and caregivers, yes, sir.
That are legitimate. And so, and I'm not talking about somebody who's a little over the line. I'm talking about somebody who's really pretending and really doing a major grow. They would probably have to seek another attorney, I would
That's often, Chair Cruz, Representative Barker, that's often the case. But let me tell you what's really the problem. The problem is if I held in this hand an ounce of marijuana, and I held in this hand an ounce of marijuana, a patient would look at this hand and see an ounce of therapeutic cannabis, and law enforcement would see in this hand an ounce of product. So law enforcement sees, for example, in the southern part of the state where there's a good growing climate, plants that, as Mr. Welty testified to, can produce, you know, several pounds, and a patient would see that plant and say, well, that's great. I'm going to have enough medicine to last. And if there's any excess, if, you know, at less than an ounce intervals for no consideration, I can share that with other patients, which is really good, because the biggest problem with the Medical Marijuana Act is that at some point in time, some patient doesn't have the medical marijuana that they need. Law enforcement sees those plants and says, that's $20,000 worth of product. He's got to be sorely tempted to sell that, and I think he is selling it, and so I think he's abusing the act, and I think that's what they're saying when they say that there's abuse of the act, and it's suspicion and hyperbole and suggestion, and it's the kind of stuff we heard in 1998. It's Chicken Little, the sky is falling kind of stuff. It isn't there. Respectfully. I mean, I'd like to see Mr. Welty's list, and, you know, perhaps we could continue this conversation, but I really think that's the situation, sir.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative.
Todd DeLotto.
Good morning, Chair Cruz and committee. My name is Todd DeLotto. I'm the president and co-founder of Compassion Center. We're a nonprofit organization in Eugene that educates patients, professionals, and the public on medical marijuana, on the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act and related aspects. And we also provide support services to patients as well. We have over 400 members, and our original intention was to serve the Eugene-Springfield area, but because there is such a high need for our services, we end up serving people from several hours away. So I do have, you know, daily contact with patients who have all kinds of different needs and helping them out, whether it's legal, medical, horticultural. Anyway, I also have been participating in regular meetings with Dr. Higginson and Mary Leverett from the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program to hopefully guide the progress of the program consistent with patient needs. You know, I appreciate this committee and those that are present here today who have a sincere interest and intention to move this program and the legislation associated with it forward consistent with the needs of thousands of seriously ill Oregonians. I've read and analyzed House Bill 2939 and found the majority of the changes that are proposed here are a tremendous contrast to the wisdom that patients, advocates, and organizations have generated from 4 years of implementing OMA. In fact, some of the proposed changes make compliance much more difficult. It increases the risk of arrest for patients and limits patients' access to caregivers. And here I'll highlight some of my concerns. The changes that deal with denying, revoking, and permanently preventing patients who have prior convictions are a grave concern of mine. As both Stormy and Lee Berger have mentioned, prior to OMA's passage in 1998, patients did not have the legal protection that they do now, and they were also precluded from a choice of evil's defense or affirmative defense. So, you know, basically denying patients legal protection under OMA, you know, would force them into committing criminal acts in order to get their medicine. What I've found before OMA and what I've found after is if a patient depends upon a medicine for their well-being, health, and sometimes even for their life, they will often choose to break the law rather than being denied of that medicine if that's the best, most effective, and safest medicine there is available. So I have a serious concern about providing the authority for the OMMP to revoke, deny, or permanently prevent a patient from obtaining a card with a prior conviction. I'm also concerned about the issue around having a patient about a patient with a caregiver not being able to be a caregiver for others. The Dash One amendments are certainly an improvement because the prior wording would mean that a designated caregiver who is a cardholder would be precluded from being a caregiver. So I'm glad that wording was at least improved a bit. Aside from the wording glitch, the proposed amendment would greatly limit patients' access to designated primary caregivers. Two of the greatest challenges that patients are facing with OMA are, one, getting enough medicine, a reliable supply of medicine, and having a reliable caregiver, which ties in with that. Because OMA is only 4 years old, most patients and caregivers lack extensive experience with growing marijuana. It does take some skill to grow. What happens oftentimes is patients become they learn how to grow. We teach classes at the Compassion Center in Eugene on how beginners may cultivate their own medicine. So it takes some time. Sometimes it takes two or three crops, which means over a year of trial and error for a patient, a beginner gardener patient, to be able to provide themselves with a significant amount, a reliable supply of medicine, sometimes over a year. And when a patient does become confident in their gardening abilities and their ability to provide themselves with medicine, they often like to extend that skill to help other patients who aren't so fortunate. For instance, if a patient has a successful garden, it often doesn't take that much more investment to expand that garden to accommodate other patients. So, what makes the Oregon medical marijuana program unique and special is that basically there are three ways to get medicine. One, grow it yourself. Two, designate a caregiver to grow it for you. Or to share with other cardholders in amounts under an ounce. And that aspect of sharing has been embraced by patients, and it's what we're as a Compassion Center is attempting. We're basically trying to make the law of what comes around goes around work, to encourage people to share their medicine, which is really difficult with broad scale prohibition in effect, because with broad scale prohibition in effect, there's going to be a black market, there's going to be a street value to this crop, so there are going to be problems with thefts and such. But while this medicine is of value to a patient as medicine, and medicine alone, the value of sharing with each other is a real bonding between patients helping out patients. So I don't think there should be anything precluding a patient from helping out another patient. And also, the roles of the primary caregiver are not limited to just growing medicine for a patient. As the definition says, is any adult who has significant responsibility for managing the well-being of a person who has been diagnosed with a debilitating medical condition. Well, sure, growing medicine is, I agree, providing significant responsibility for someone's well-being and their care. But there are a lot of other roles that caregivers serve. Like this gentleman mentioned, he makes preparations, you know, culinary preparations of medicine for his son and other patients. This is one role. Any caregiver who helps out a patient with their use of marijuana, whether they're baking brownies, helping a quadriplegic medicate by holding a pipe up to their lips, by growing for them, by helping process their medicine, there are a lot of roles, and it's not just limited to growing. So a circumstance may be that a patient who is able to grow for themselves may also find it necessary to designate a primary caregiver to help them in some of the other roles associated with their use, production, or delivery of medicine. And since that patient is also able to grow for themselves, they may also be able to grow for other patients. So that change right there would preclude that from happening, preclude that patient from being able to help out another patient, even though they have a caregiver to help them with their other needs. So I agree with your questioning that I can't see any reason why this would be of any benefit to patients or even any benefit, you know, to law enforcement or the program. The department informing the attending physician of a previous diagnosis by another attending physician regarding the contraindication of medical marijuana, I see that as an unnecessary bureaucratic step. You know, attending physicians normally view patients' medical records as part of standard medical practice. They review patients' medical records, you know, prior to, you know, recommending treatment, etc. So in doing so, a doctor would usually see, would be able to read what a prior physician has noted regarding a patient's medical marijuana use, and take that into consideration with what they decide to do with this patient. So, you know, this is standard medical practice, so I don't see any benefit to require the OMMP office to notify the doctor of what the doctor would already have in the file, most likely. And also, I see no benefit for a physician to receive information about a patient's treatment plan, you know, from an OMMP, you know, clerk who isn't a medical professional. Also, regarding the education issue, I'm happy to see that the Dash 1 amendments eliminate the requirement of a course, of a patient attending a course. As a president of an organization that focuses on educating the public and patients about medical marijuana, you know, we value education very highly, and we do, as an organization, provide resources. I teach two classes a month. One is an intro to OMA class. Oh, I teach several classes a month, but two of those is an introduction to the Oregon Medical Marijuana class. It's a PowerPoint presentation with everything about how the basics of how the program works. There are other classes similar around the state in Portland by other organizations. I also teach an advanced OMA class for those who want to continue in their understanding of the complicated details of how the program works. You know, so the resources for patients to get this type of information are out there. So I certainly wouldn't want to require them having a course. And I do question the requirement to have them state that they've read materials provided by OMMP. One, because basically any time myself or almost anyone asks the OMMP acting program manager or Dr. Higginson regarding a legal clarification of OMA, almost always we're told that, well, we can't give a legal clarification. We'll have to, you know, send that to the Attorney General's office for an opinion. You know, for the practice of continually trying to avoid giving legal opinion about OMA, I would hesitate to have them required to provide this educational information and also to back up what Lee says about how OMA is implemented and interpreted by 36 different district attorneys. I think there will be quite a problem of gray areas there. There are a number of gray areas in the law, and a lot of those get worked out through, through just practicing the law. And I don't, you know, so I kind of question that requirement. Let's see, some other concerns I have is requiring the person's growth site to be listed on their registry card. Basically, I think this would put patients at risk for theft if they happen to get their wallets lost or stolen. Anyone, especially if it was stolen, you know, anyone who would steal a wallet would find an OMMP card, a medical marijuana card, with an address of where their grow site is located and say, well, gosh, you know, I mean, if this person is willing to steal somebody's wallet, perhaps they'd be willing to visit that site that says where they're growing marijuana. So I think that would put patients at risk. Where it requires this is a 309 sub 10A. Where it says updated written documentation stating the person continues to be diagnosed, etc., requiring the patient documents the grow site as part of their application. This issue came up, very similar wording was added to the Oregon Administrative Rules in I believe it was the last rule change, it may possibly have been 99. But anyway, this similar wording got inserted in there that kind of slipped by us. There was a little wording glitch which came up. Basically, without saying, if applicable, you know, attached to requiring them document where their grow site is listed. Without saying if applicable, this wording would make Oregon the first state to require patients to grow medical marijuana. Like I said, similar wording was used in 2001 amendment to the administrative rules. OMMP then began denying applications of patients who have not yet decided upon a location or caregiver to grow their medication. I participated in an OMMP advisory committee meeting on May 28th of last year to deal with this problem. The advisory committee included patient advocates as well as representatives from law enforcement and the Attorney General's Association. And after we all understood the problem, my recollection is we were all in agreement that it is a good idea to require patients to register their grow site if they have one, and that patients should not be denied for a lack of a place to grow their medicine. So this change, without the wording, if applicable, would therefore harm patients that are already in the unfortunate position of not having a place to grow their medicine. So I'd recommend deleting that amendment or adding if applicable. Where in 302 sub 6 where it says grow site The definition of grow site means the street address where medical marijuana will be produced. I question the use of street address because there are a number of patients that live in rural areas which sometimes the street address is not clear, and it's maybe easier for law enforcement, especially doing aerial surveys, to be notified of a more reasonable location rather than a street address. That's a minor one. There are some things. Well, also getting back to the abuse issue, some law enforcement representatives testified to rampant abuse of this program, and myself, agreeing with Lee Berger, I haven't seen that. Like I said, we have 400 members. We have hundreds of people coming through for help at the center every week, and we really haven't seen any of the abuses. I haven't heard of the 200 plant case in Lane County. It's pretty much void. Basically all the law enforcement that I usually talk to even says themselves that they're surprised at how little abuse is occurring. What I believe may be misinterpreted or calculated as abuse are cases where a patient may have been a little bit over the limit, or the patient didn't fully understand all the legal implications. So yeah, I do agree there may be a little bit of an understanding of the law issue. But also, this law is extremely difficult for patients to get a reliable supply of medicine under. I always say the law was written to pass and it wasn't written to work. And I encourage, the efforts here to help make this program work, because it's a tremendous step forward from where we were over 4 years ago. However, we still have issues that make it extremely difficult for patients to get their medicine under this law. Some of those has to do with plant limits, possession limits, particularly caregiver issues, doctor issues, the ability to find a cooperative physician. So in trying to acquire enough medicine, especially if patients are beginner growers, they would tend to they may be tempted to grow more than the legal amount just to make sure they had enough medicine. If getting enough medicine is important to a patient, that they're willing to grow a little bit more just in case of crop loss, have enough at the end, then as long as they have a sincere intention of using it only for their medicinal benefit and that their end result was to comply with the law, I really encourage leniency with law enforcement, and I also encourage further improvements with OMA, particularly to increase the plant limits, remove mature designation from the plant limits, increase possession limits, and these sorts of necessary changes. Advocates have been voicing a whole list of necessary changes ever since the law was implemented. And I really encourage a lot of these issues to be addressed. This bill here that we have in front of us, I believe, has many, many flaws. Some of the changes that I support, include adding Alzheimer's disease to the legislation. It's already, in place for the, administrative rules. And some of the, basically renumbering and any of that cleanup work. But the basic real changes here, I think go to the detriment of patients. And if it's possible to salvage this bill, I highly recommend including changes such as, like I just mentioned, including plant limits, possession limits, things that really make it, that work to the best interest of patients. And to speak to the emergency, issue. I'm surprised to hear Dr. Higginson state that it's an emergency because we've been in regular meetings with him over the past year and a half, and it's never come to our attention that any of these problems addressed are an emergency. So it's surprising to hear. I would, however, say that if a patient, if a significant number of patients, which most patients under OMA do not get enough medicine for their medicinal needs, I would more likely consider that to be an emergency and to, you know, request that action be taken immediately to address that. And basically, that's about it for my testimony. I'd be happy to answer further questions, and I'm also available for recommendations for further improvements to OMA as well.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Sandy Burbank and Madeline Martinez.
And I think Madeline just left.
Madeline just left?
It's Sandy
just left. Well, then we'll...
I might be done by the time she gets back.
Okay. Yeah. Vicki, do you want to come up? Vicki Jasper?
Right here.
Yeah, you want to come up too, please? Go ahead.
Hello, Representative Kruse, members of the committee. My name is Sandy Burbank. I live at 2255 State Road in Mosier, Oregon. I have copies of my testimony that I prepared last night, but most of it, after looking at the amendments, is actually inappropriate. So I'm not even going to give it to you. I'm just going to take it from the top and try to go through this as fast as I can. I called this an attack on the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act because the bill as introduced really was that. It was an attack that I felt came from law enforcement. I've been involved in the issue of medical marijuana since 1991 when I met 5 legal medical marijuana patients that were getting their medicine from the federal government. I was with one of those patients when they suddenly turned very gray from pain, very gray. They had a disease I don't even remember, something I'm sure most of us haven't heard of. I watched them medicate, I watched their color come back, and the first time I realized this was truly medicine for this man. And this man who was doing this had walked away from using 7 to 9 Percodan a day to using no Percodan whatsoever, and he uses still to this day, provided by the federal government, only medical marijuana. That was the beginning of a change in my mind about how marijuana was medicine. I worked with Laird on the bills that he spoke of earlier that was represented by Senator Roberts, but actually we worked on bills prior to that. Always it came down to the issue of where would we get the supply of medicine. We could see very obviously it was not going to come through the legislature and that we were going to have to do something through a citizen initiative. In 1996, we had the Compassionate Oregonian Voters effort. Stormy Ray, Laird, and I worked on that. And we only had it out for a year, but we were able to discuss the issue of medical marijuana quite a bit. And then in 97 and 98, the OMMA passed. I helped in the writing of that. We did see that after we left the meeting with the political people that were getting paid to run it, that they made changes that made it easier to pass and made it harder, actually, for patients to get medicine. That was sad. However, OMMA is a very excellent law, and we've been meeting with the health department. I'm the director of Mothers Against Misuse and Abuse, and we have advocated now for access to medical marijuana since 1991. We've been meeting as patient advocates with the health department bi-monthly or even monthly for a while since 2001, August of 2001. And it is with sadness that I report that instead of working with us on bills that might have made improvements to make access for the patients easier, the agency, the health department, have been working with law enforcement instead. And I don't quite understand that attitude. It does seem like, since they know of the problems that are occurring, that they would have wanted to make improvements to the act.
In spite of complex rules and the fear of federal law, this program is working, saving money for Oregon Health Department and bringing relief to many who cannot use harsh prescription drugs. Just recently in my county, Wasco County, we had hospice come forward and help a man who was dying from prostate cancer. He was using a great deal of morphine. They decided to help him get medical marijuana, and what happened after that surprised him, them and him. He didn't live the 2 weeks that was expected. Instead, he walked away from the morphine. He used medical marijuana. His quality of life was much better, and he lived 7 more weeks. And repeatedly, even the state worker who helped him die the last 2 days reported how much the medical marijuana helped him and how happy he was because he had access to it. So what we're seeing is that the Oregon Health Plan is actually saving money as many people walk away from harsh prescription drugs because the side effects are so severe, and instead, because the health plan does not cover the costs of medical marijuana, they have to figure out a way to get their medicine in an alternative mode. I'm going to go over this just as quickly as I can, just commenting on the amendments. First of all, there is no emergency. I don't even know where that came from, and it wasn't even an emergency when the bill got written up, and I don't know how it got an emergency so quickly. Half-blind here. One of the things that we're concerned about is having addresses on the card as they exist now. Right now, if you lose your wallet or have your wallet stolen, there is a card in your wallet that has your name, your address, and then there was also at least proposed to add the grow site. I'm glad to hear that that's not going to happen, but we're still lobbying to get both the name and addresses off the card, so it's just a picture and a number that could either be swiped. There's really no reason to have those addresses on there. The address of the caregiver is on the card. The address of the patient is on the card. And those places, both of them, you could, if anybody found them, they're probably going to guess that there's marijuana there, and marijuana still in the black market is worth a lot of money. And one of the bigger problems that we're having is actually theft. The part about the educational materials, I'm glad that that got changed to not being a course. Personally, I think the health department has been a little slow in getting educational materials out there to people. Some of the stuff that's out there isn't really very informative to the patients. It doesn't help them know how to talk to their doctors, and a lot of things like that. But I am at least glad that they would put out educational materials rather than have a class. The part about the department informing an attending physician if there's been a previous diagnosis by another attending physician that the applicant is no longer affected by a debilitating condition or that the medical marijuana use is counterindicated. I can see reasons why that would be good, but I also see reasons why that could be used to intimidate doctors who would be the second doctor. There are many, many conditions out there where we have doctors that disagree about how to treat a condition, and we heard earlier people suggest that doctors could even maybe do this because the bill hasn't been paid. So I would be worried about this. I would be worried that perhaps the second doctor would feel pressure perhaps from the federal government, which is a lot of what happens. Another part in here is the part where the renewals right now are set up. Right now we have a situation where a lot of doctors are afraid to sign. I can't tell you how many patients I've talked to whose doctors know they use medical marijuana. They use it with their blessing. However, they're terrified of the federal government. They're afraid of the Oregon Medical Association that tells them not to sign. So a lot of them will not sign the first time, which says they have to write down that marijuana might help, or at least they have to include that in the medical records. The second time around, all the doctor has to do is verify that the condition hasn't changed. So what we've been seeing happen in the last couple of years as people are coming around for renewals is that their original physician, who was afraid to sign for the card, is not afraid to sign to verify that the condition hasn't changed. And in fact, they're happy to be able to do that. They're just afraid to write that part down that marijuana might help. They're afraid of the federal government. They're afraid of their license to prescribe. And seeing what's going on in California, it's probably a valid fear. So I would ask that you not add that part. Leave it the way it is right now. Let the patient's real preferred personal physician be able to deal with this issue after they've gotten certified the first time. What happened to my paper? The last thing that I've heard a lot of discussion about here is the caregiver issue. First of all, if a patient is violating the law and if they're making sales, bust them. That's how I feel about it. I'm very protective of this program. If the law is being violated, the police have plenty of opportunity to get search warrants and to arrest people and to just bust them. And that's what I think they should do. I'm appalled by people that would take advantage of patients and try to make money on this act. It's just unconscionable to me. But people will hire caregivers, or hire, I wish. People will obtain caregivers for a lot of reasons, but they can't hire them. Be clear that they cannot pay a caregiver for their time on any level. All they can do is, at most, reimburse the caregiver for their true expense of electricity or fertilizer or, you know, that kind of thing. But they cannot reimburse them for their time at all. People get caregivers to help them for a lot of reasons. Those reasons might be because they live in a house that is so small, or an apartment or a place where they can't grow marijuana at all. It takes room to grow these plants. You have to have, because of the way the law is set up, you're not allowed to grow outdoors and just store it like you would your, you know, pickles or whatever. You can only do a little bit at a time. So everybody is forced into growing indoors. Well, those lights that you use to grow indoors are very hot, and you have to have circulation, and you have to have ventilation, and all kinds of things like this. And a lot of people do not have those circumstances. And a lot of people are in care facilities where they don't have those circumstances. So they have to get somebody else to grow from them. Not necessarily because they're not able to do it physically, but because their circumstances leave them unable to produce their medicine. Another reason that people will get caregivers to help them is for the issue of security. Now, this is something I haven't heard anybody else mention here today, but it is a very common thing. It is, from my perspective, it has been our responsibility to keep our medicine out of the hands of those people who are not certified. Consequently, if you're growing cannabis, whether it be indoors or outdoors, but especially outdoors, you have to have 24-hour-a-day security, and to think that you don't is foolish. A lot of people try it. They get ripped off. All kinds of things happen to them. And you can't have that. You've got to have 24-hour-a-day security. So a lot of times, the person that you get as your caregiver is really there. Maybe they're going to help you water a little bit. Maybe they'll take care of your plants when you leave to go away for a week's vacation. But in my case, we live in a rural area where we're vulnerable. I have to have somebody there 24 hours a day. So my son is my caregiver. I do almost all of the growing. He doesn't, but he'll be there to watch to be sure somebody doesn't come in and steal it while we're gone. And I really, and I'm a patient, and I grow for other patients. This last one, it makes no sense whatsoever. I cannot even understand why they would not want patients growing for other patients. That would be the first line of defense, it would seem. A patient would turn to another patient for their excess. I really support Stormy's idea, the very first testimony, of taking out the word mature in the number of ounces that you could have. If you could have 1 ounce of cannabis for every plant that you had, it would raise that limit to 7. That would be a little bit, 7 ounces then. It would be 7, 1 per each plant, 7 plants, 7 ounces. That would be a little bit better. But when you look at people who have MS or who have glaucoma or that kind of thing, they're going to be using 1 ounce of cannabis a week on the average. You're talking only 7 weeks at a time, and it takes from 6 months to 4 months to produce any medicine. And you do the arithmetic. Obviously, the 3 ounces that we have now are not enough, and the 7 ounces, were it allowed, would still not be enough. But at least it would be a step in the right direction. These are the kinds of changes I wish the health department would help us bring to you as changes to the law, rather than the kind of thing that we've got here. But in general, with the amendments, except for that last one's really bad, I find that this bill is a lot better than it was presented. And instead of my saying to you, which I did at the last, which is do not support this attack on OMMA, I can say that thank you very much for all the work you've done as community members, for all the people who have been talking to you, and for your understanding and compassion of looking at this and seeing that maybe the spirit could be changed and we could turn this into a good bill instead of a bad bill. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Question?
Ms. Burbank, to which change were you referring? You said the last amendment.
The one that said that patients couldn't be caregivers if they had patients couldn't be caregivers if they had a caregiver themselves.
Got it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And folks, it's 10 to 12, and I've still got 10 people that want to testify, so let's try to keep it as concise as we can.
Okay.
Madeline.
Oh, okay. Oh, you're next. Good
morning. It's still morning. Committee members, I'm here. My name is Madeline Martinez, and I am a disabled American, an American with disabilities. I'm also a member of Multnomah Disability Services Advisory Council. I'm a member of the Advisory Committee to the Department of Human Services, and I agree. I am so saddened that they didn't come to us to work on some of the issues that we would have liked to see change. I'd like to first start with the last topic that Sandy Burbank brought up, where 1 ounce a week is what patients on average with serious medical conditions need. And we, Sandy Burbeck and myself, have gone to various district attorneys to talk about some clarifications in the law. As you know, it is very vague, and we wanted to know what guidelines we should follow so that we do not violate the law and lose our cards. Our experience has been that law enforcement is the least educated about the law, and that is very sad and unfortunate. As a retired peace officer, it really concerns me. I had to take quite a few classes on drugs, and I don't see it happening out here. I first approached law enforcement at a blues festival at Tomahawk Waterfront Park about 3 years ago, and this was the Portland Police Bureau, and I wanted direction on where I could go to medicate out of public view because I was concerned about losing my card, of course, and I did not want to disrespect anyone. There are children and various people there, and the only other alternative was to go and medicate in the disabled stall, the restroom outside, which was not something that I wanted to do. And when I asked these 3 officers for direction, they all looked at each other confused. And I said, surely, officer, you're familiar with the law, OMA. I'm a medical marijuana patient, and I need to medicate with cannabis now. It's been a few hours. And he said, go to the middle of the park over there, which I knew would be a violation of the law. So, of course, I didn't follow his direction. And what I've been trying to do is get law enforcement to educate themselves. In September of 2002, I had a knock at my door at 11 o'clock at night from the Clackamas County Sheriff's, who wanted to know why it smelled like, you know, marijuana. And so we showed them our card, and they said, well, they had no idea how many plants I should have. They had no idea about the program, period, is what they said. They went to a car and found, I had informed them that we could have 7 plants. And they went to the car, and they said, hey, you can have 7 plants. And I said, yes, I just let you know that. And they said, okay, well, we think you have more than 7 plants. We live in a 2-bedroom apartment. We couldn't have very many. But I said, well, a minute ago you didn't know how many I could have, and now you feel that I'm violating the law. And of course I was suspect because I was a medical marijuana patient of criminal activity. Well, I was very upset. They didn't have a warrant, but I did let them in because they really ticked me off at calling me a liar and suspect. So they came in, they were very embarrassed. I filed I just filed that I was very upset that they were trained in the law and followed through. And so hopefully law enforcement is also getting some training. I'm glad to see that people will be getting training. But, you know, as a person that works with the disabled, many of us have learning disabilities, and reading materials is not always the easiest. So we do have to work in other ways. As someone said, perhaps our caregivers could read these materials to them. And I'm also disappointed and concerned that I'm, as well as Sandy, a member of the Advocates Advisory Committee to the Department of Human Services, that they didn't come to us to talk about some of the changes that have been made here. And I'm glad to see that they were amended, because some of them, I mean, in this program as it is, we jump through all these hoops to register as a patient or a caregiver. And some of these things that were in 2939, quite frankly, light those hoops on fire, because how are we going to make it through this? I mean, if I were not able to help other patients, they wouldn't have medicine. You know, and I can grow 14 plants in my home because my husband's a patient as well as myself. So we can help a lot of people with this medicine. But my other concern is when we met with Sergeant Larry Welty of the state police, we talked to him about perhaps changing to federal guidelines, the compassionate law, the federal compassionate law, which allows 2 ounces per week. And I think that's more what we need to move towards, instead of trying to limit the amounts, because we are, after all, helping each other out. That was the spirit of the law, that we could exchange within an ounce to another registered card holder. So I can give a caregiver medicine an ounce or under to give, to provide for his, for another person's patient. And I'm glad to see, as I said, that you've amended some of these things, but, you know, they did concern me. They're, I think that I saw it as an attack and targeting the disabled, as an advocate for the disabled, because some, all of us, all medical marijuana patients are disabled to varying degrees, but nonetheless, I'm looking forward to the day when we would be covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act, quite frankly, so that we could medicate out of public view in various places. You know, someone goes in the restroom and uses insulin, how can we stop them from doing that? But that's not even a sanitary place to use insulin. So we should, you know, hopefully, futuristically speaking, we will have a medical lounge, so to speak, where people can go and medicate out of public view. I have conducted a, or been part of roll call here with the state police to let them know about what goes on and how the law works, showed them a card. None of them had any idea what it looked like or how to honor it. And another thing that we've done, I'm also the executive director of Oregon Normal, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. And what we've done is we had to develop a patient, medical cannabis patient handbook ourselves, excuse me. And I think the Department of Human Services should be utilizing that handbook by putting it out and sending it to each patient that gets a card, because it's sort of like a driver's manual. Here you go. You know, because you just get that law and it's so extensive. You don't sit down and read it. Most patients don't. Sandy and I and a lot of others particularly have, because we have to deal with it. We're the advocates. People look for look to us for information. But I think it's important that finally we're going to educate people, and I think that a handbook needs to be drawn up not only for patients but also for law enforcement as well as doctors, because Conant versus McCaffrey was the Ninth Circuit Court said that no doctor needs to fear losing their license because of recommending medical marijuana to a patient. And people don't know that. So one of the things Oregon Normal worked to do was to get that into the application packet. And thank you, we were successful, to Mary Leverett, who helped me get it into the application packet. And now patients can actually take this to their doctors, although many doctors still are very scared of the federal government, which I, you know, don't blame them. Of course, what we do need to do is reschedule marijuana, because we're sending a bad message to youth that if marijuana is on the same schedule as heroin, should they run across marijuana and happen to smoke a joint with one of their friends, well, next they'll be going out and shooting up heroin, because after all, people are telling them, our government is saying it's the same schedule, so it's the same kind of drug, which is not true, as we all know. And I want to thank you for making these amendments, you know, and I know you have other people to speak, so thank you so much. I'm sure you don't have any questions for me. It's been a long day.
Thank you.
Good morning. I come from the Earl Blumenauer School of Public Speaking, which is to say that my remarks will be brief, cogent, and delivered in under 4 minutes. All I ask is your undivided attention during that short period of time. Honorable committee members and distinguished guests, good morning. My name is Vicki Jasper, and I'm a lifelong resident of Oregon. I'm a mother, a grandmother, I'll have to say today, a peacenik, and a sufferer of chronic and disabling illnesses. That's the only credibility or credential I have to waive here today, is that I'm a patient. I've been participating in the Oregon Medicinal Marijuana program for a little over 2 years. My biggest problem in this program is lack of consistent access to quality medicine and caregivers. House Bill 2939, absent the amendments, I will say I wrote this before the amendments, I read the amendments, actually takes the medicinal marijuana program backward by making it more difficult for patients to get medicine, and it does so in the following ways. First of all, by shrinking the pool of possible caregivers by prohibiting patients acting as primary caregivers. As many other people have stated, there I don't see any clear logic behind this section, and I believe it's an unnecessary imposition of the law in a patient's life. It also makes it more difficult to get meds by violating the doctor-patient confidentiality privilege by reporting on opinions from other doctors to one's primary care physician without the patient's permission. This will have a chilling effect on patients as well as doctors, contravenes many existing laws, and I believe infringes on constitutional privacy rights. Third, requiring a state-run educational component, I'm glad to see that this has been changed. I agree with Dr. Higginson's amendment, although, again, interpretations of the law notwithstanding, I think an educational component run by the state could have been a disaster. Who has the knowledge and credibility to run it, basically, or the time at this point, or the money? Fourthly, disallowing one convicted of a prior drug offense from participating in the medicinal marijuana program is going to make it more difficult for patients and caregivers alike. Aside from inflicting additional punishment after the fact, this provision punishes those Vietnam veterans, being one obvious example, who have used marijuana medicinally before it was legally sanctioned. And believe me that legitimate participants in this program are just as concerned as law enforcement about abuses in the program. Like Sandy, I say if somebody's abusing the program, they should be busted. They should be pulled out of the program and exposed. I don't want, and I've had people ask me, oh, you've got a card, can you help me out? No, no way. I don't even take that as a joke. That's not even funny. I think, however, that putting our confidence in the little three-letter word may, the department may disallow a patient from participating, I don't have any confidence in that. I think that provision should be stricken or severely somehow pruned back. For instance, Vietnam veterans that were using medicinal marijuana in 1970, 1980, 1990, they will then be forced to continue in the black market use of marijuana because of this provision. Overall, I think House Bill 2939 should not pass, should not be enacted. I do think the amendments have helped a great deal, but I think this bill needs more work. Thank you very much. I'm ready for any questions.
Any questions? Ladies, thank you very much. Paul Antos, and I think Max is outside. He should be on his way in.
Two quick points to make. My name's Paul Antos. I come from Glide, Oregon. Basically, it's the limiting factor of the amount of cardholders. What we're doing with the police department now is trying to limit cardholders. If I happen to be growing 200 marijuana plants and I'm a cardholder and the cops come in and pop me, they bust me. I'm on probation. They can come out anytime they want at 1 o'clock in the morning, at 3 o'clock in the morning. They can check my whole property. They can check anywhere I am. Okay, all we're really doing is removing more people from the rolls. The last point is the piece of paper I just gave you. I'll make this quick. Basically, understood as I wrote this up, there are basically about 4,000 medical marijuana cardholders. Cardholders may not buy or sell, but must grow. Cardholders growing medicine necessarily grants to cardholders uniformity of medicine. Since cardholders now grow and may not buy or sell, the card program necessarily removes from the black market an equal volume of marijuana. 2002 price averages were more or less the following: $150 an ounce for pressed marijuana on the black market, $350 an ounce for green bud on the black market. Medicine usage by cardholders varies. However, 1 ounce per month and 1 ounce per week seems to reflect average low and high usage by cardholders, some who smoke their medicine and some who eat their medicine. At 1 ounce per month, $150 ounce of pressed Mexican times 12 months equals $1,800 per year per card, times 4,000 cards equals $7.2 million. Okay, on pressed Mexican. At $350 an ounce for green bud times 12 months is $4,200 a year per card, times 4,000 cards is $16.8 million. At 1 ounce per week, $150 pressed times 52 weeks is $7,800 per card per year, times 4,000 cards is $31.2 million. $350 ounce green bud times 52 ounces a week equals $18,000 a year, times 4,000 cards is $72.8 million per year in 2002 that was removed from the black market. Possibly, we could have had that $72.8 million removed from the black market. That money has gone back into our state commerce. This is our money. It's not going to Mexico. It's not going to Texas. It's not going to some drug cartel. It could be going to people who supply lights for indoor growth. Basically, that's all I have to say. Any questions?
Any questions?
Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. For the record, committee, we have submitted testimony from Michael James Long that Sandy just gave you. Next up, Edward Glick and Gregory Byers.
My name is, good morning, or I guess it's good afternoon now, Mr. Chair, crews and committee members. My name is Kenneth Gregory Byers. I live at 185 Yola Drive Northwest in Salem, Oregon. I'm a U.S. citizen and an honorably discharged U.S. Naval veteran, having served meritoriously in the waters in and off the coast of Vietnam. Upon completion of my enlistment, I returned to my Oregon home where I raised a family, earned a college degree, spent 24 years working as a dedicated employee and community member. I did this until I got too ill to perform my duties as a master technician and shop foreman in a nearby automobile dealership. I'm not currently receiving any state or federal assistance. For many years before I retired, I repeatedly sought treatment for increasingly severe joint pain and uncomfortable, uncontrollable bowel problems. I was treated with all the usual medications and treatments. Some worked to a degree of success, some didn't work at all. But the most noticeable traits were that none worked well enough to alleviate any one symptom without creating another. NSAIDs, anti-inflammatories, are notorious for damaging stomach and intestinal tissues. Painkillers are notoriously addictive, hard on your intestines, and very detrimental to clear thinking. All current treatments are counterindicated if used for too long a period, as they will adversely affect other vital organs such as kidney and liver. Through investigating old medical journals and other alternative medical treatment methods, I stumbled upon relief from all of my muscle spasms and nausea and most of the pain I was suffering through the use of cannabis. I spoke with my doctor, and he agrees that cannabis is the best therapy for much of what ails me. I am now enrolled in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program as a patient and as a caregiver grower. My doctor is in favor of my continued use of cannabis as an antispastic and anti-nausea agent, and my continued use of cannabis as a pain reducer and anti-inflammatory medication as well. As an OMA patient, I am using cannabis to help mitigate the nausea and muscle spasms associated with irritable bowel syndrome and to relieve the pain and not muscle spasms associated with degenerative joint disease. I have both osteo and rheumatoid types of arthritis, as well as other joint, nerve, muscle, and ligament damage. As a caregiver grower in the OMA program, I produce consumable cannabis cannabis for two other patients. Neither is able to grow acceptable medical-grade cannabis, either due to physical limitations or the lack of suitable space and skill. Not everyone is able to grow the quantity and quality of cannabis plants, especially indoors, needed to produce suitable quality medication that is allowable under the current act. These people would be forced to commit illegal acts by going to the black market in order to acquire medication or to go without medication deemed therapeutic by the doctor due to no system of distribution. Making it so that a relatively healthy patient cannot grow for another less able patient, or restricting access to the OMA program simply because a person had a conviction for a nonviolent drug war offense, this is mean-spirited and counterproductive. If they have served their sentence and paid their fines, why should they be discriminated against when they are the best resource for many ill and unskilled gardeners? The introduction of this new language in the OMA program will deny many otherwise eligible people access to the compassion available through this act. Clarification of this new language and its meaning must occur with compassion and common sense. This must happen before any legislative approval of such a major restructuring of a twice-approved voter initiative affecting the many thousands of people enrolled in the program. What does it mean when the Act says, as part of the verification process, the department shall inform the attending physician if there has been a previous diagnosis by another attending physician, that an applicant is no longer affected by a debilitating medical condition, or that continued use of medical marijuana is counterindicated? How will the department determine if another attending physician says anything regarding the patient? Will this open a patient's record to DHS, judicial, or police examination? If one doctor says no, doesn't the patient have a right to a second opinion? Many doctors are afraid of the federal government and its control over a doctor's ability to prescribe controlled substances. Many doctors won't even look at evidence contrary to the federal position. Prior to 1937, the American Medical Association's approved pharmacopoeia for the Western medical provider included over 100 medical compounds containing cannabinoids that were used to treat more than 50 ailments, including alcoholism, addiction to tobacco, cocaine, and opiates. The currently accepted conditions OMA includes are not considered curable. Cannabis is not a cure. It is a treatment for a debilitating condition. It was used to treat pain, cramps, muscle spasms, coughs, and many other medical conditions. Part of this new language, doesn't this also become an issue of unlawful search and seizure? Additionally, won't this potentially erode self-incrimination protection as well? I'm very curious as to what sort of educational course the legislators sponsoring this bill envision DHS to have and how it will be implemented on persons already enrolled in the program. I'm hoping the classes will be of the variety that will enable patients to grow and process their medicine in a safe, clean, and healthy manner. I fear it will be more of the same war on drugs rhetoric pushed on to the public as truth by our DEA and Department of Justice. What will constitute the successful completion of the education course? What exactly does the phrase, when a person has been convicted of violating the ORS 475.92992 1A, B, and C, or an equivalent offense in another jurisdiction mean? How far back in a person's life does this apply? If a person has had a youthful indiscretion, by our President Bush's own admission definition as being anything that occurred as late as but prior to his 40th birthday, is this going to be held against them? How should this affect a person's right to the best medicine to treat their ills and the rigors of their disease? A murderer, a rapist, a grand theft, a thief has a right to cannabis, but not so for a person that has a nonviolent drug conviction. This is clearly discriminatory language. The department may permanently prohibit a person from making further application if a person's application was denied under subsection 6C of this section. Seems to be as discriminatory as the previous section for the same reasons. Adding the requirement of having a patient's grow site on the registry card is potentially very hazardous to the patient and to their grower, if they have one. Currently, the OMA card has sufficient information for the police to access the patient grower data in the DHS system. If the police force has some concern that a garden is out of compliance, or if they just want to inspect the garden, they have that right already. As for the location of the garden, this information is already available in the patient's application in their file at DHS. There's also the phone number of the OMA office on the card. Adding the address of the patient garden, where easily hundreds if not thousands of dollars of cannabis and growing equipment are located, is inviting theft and insurance claims. If a person loses their card or it is stolen, they have now given a criminal more than enough information that will allow them to commit more, potentially worse crimes. Those crimes could be very brutal, as most thefts are by people seeking money for hard drugs, such as methamphetamine and cocaine, and is more apt to act in a violent manner. Will the police be ready to respond and protect a medical marijuana patient and their garden? I would like to see the department be required to send notification to a caregiver if there is any change in the patient's condition requiring further notification of the department. If a person has a caregiver growing for them, the grower is at risk of arrest if the patient decides to change growers and does not notify the grower, or the patient is dissatisfied and just wants to get even. The department has no need to notify a grower of a pending change in status. This could put an unfair burden on the caregiver grower if the patient has a conflict with that same grower. The Omicrat program has worked very well and is the only program in the state's Department of Human Services that is paying for its operation and setting aside funds for any rainy day applications. If changes are to be made to the program, I have some positive ones and will gladly speak to those at some later date. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I will gladly answer them.
Any questions? Thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, Chairman Cruz and members of the committee. My name is Edward Glick. I'm a registered nurse practicing in Oregon. I work at Good Samaritan Regional Mental Health Center in Corvallis. I also work extensively with cannabis patients and have basically worked with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act since it was conceived. I'll read a statement that's not completely appropriate since there's a number of changes here, but as I read my comments, I realized that the gist of what I want to say is the same. So I'm just going to read through, and you've heard all of the changes essentially previously stated by other people talking. So. I believe this bill should be tabled. It was written by an unsympathetic staff of the medical marijuana program and police and increases the persecutory activities that cannabis patients have long had and continue to endure. With this bill, program administration has strayed far from the compassionate and patient-centered intent of the law. I want to clearly say that I am both supportive and critical of the medical marijuana program. It has literally protected thousands of Oregonians from police contacts and loss of medicine. Its basic humanitarian aims have been met mostly under the leadership of the founding program administrator, Ms. Kelly Page. She worked tirelessly to help patients understaffed and undersupported. 2 years ago, the then Oregon Health Division, under the direction of Bobby Mink, abruptly sacked Kelly and replaced her with staff unsympathetic to the needs of cannabis patients. The program has, since that time, broken the trust of patients by a calculated pattern of expensive administrative obstructions and restrictions. This bill is a continuation of a political rather than a medical process. As far as speaking with the medical education course, I'll just say this request is burdensome and expensive to patients and has already been accomplished by numerous organizations around Oregon that assist patients, including Todd Delato from the Compassion Center, Mothers Against Misuse and Abuse, Voter Power, and the Stormy Ray Foundation, to name a few. There probably are upwards of a dozen different organizations that work extensively with patients in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, may I interrupt for a question?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
One of the concerns we heard much earlier than this morning was that people who have claimed that they're not aware of the law, etc. Mm-hmm. So how would you respond to that?
I'd say the additions that have been put into this bill are actually very admirable because there's an enormous education deficit because of the complexity of the bill and because of the differential administration of it through police departments around the state. So I would say that including educational materials with patient registration packets, posting information is very admirable. There's such an education need among patients that I would support putting that. I wouldn't mandate it. I wouldn't put signed statements where patients have to swear that they know everything and understand the vast complexity of this law, because that will turn around and bite them really hard at the point when they get caught with a larger number of plants or for one reason or another are not complying with limits. And so where they're forced to acknowledge that they understand all the complexities of this law, I think that's overreaching for patients who have very difficult times.
I don't think you can have it both ways, though. In one sense, you're saying we don't need to require them to say that they're educated, and yet you want us to provide all kinds of information and educational materials.
And yet they're
not responsible, though, for having either read or understood those materials.
My point of view after dealing with this complex law for so many years is that it's an enormously complex, difficult to understand law, and it's unreasonable to expect that cannabis patients who are suffering are going to understand the subtleties of this law when we in the advocacy community still frequently are debating different interpretations of it. And combine that with police interpretations, which are completely individualized between counties, and I think it's a monumental undertaking to expect a patient to understand the details. Now, they need to understand legal limits, and they need to understand all the different requirements. And basically, they do need to understand that. And I'm just saying, I believe that the advocacy organizations around Oregon have done a tremendous job overall with OMA classes and with tremendous numbers of classes and interaction with patients. But again, when you mandate that they are required by law to understand all the subtleties of something that lawyers argue about all the time, I believe it's something that many patients would not be able to maintain that. But there should obviously be some educational understanding. It's critically important for people to understand that.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And I'll continue here. It's the medical marijuana program itself that has neglected its educational responsibilities to patients and physicians by not carrying through with medical and educational commitments. The Department of Human Services committed 2 years ago to initiate a physician survey about the use of cannabis for anxiety. In regard to that, I was one of the panel members for the Debilitating Medical Conditions Advisory Panel, and out of, I believe, 9 members of the panel, 7 of us actually voted strenuously to include anxiety, depressive symptoms, bipolar type symptoms on the list of conditions, and I believe that was the consensus of the group, is to widen the psychiatric uses far more than eventually happened. The DHS committed to initiate a physician survey about the use of cannabis for anxiety. It was never done. As well, the program staff has never utilized a patient benefit survey evaluation for a unique state medical program with over 4,500 registrants. To not conduct data collection is negligent. Thus, it is troubling that the program now demands educational obedience of patients. Will dying cancer patients who can't attend an approved education program be denied access to a comfort measure? This administrative manipulation is evident on page 3, and I'm not sure if that's the same page. Essentially, the department shall inform the attending physician if there has been a previous diagnosis by another attending physician that continued use of marijuana is contraindicated. Why are the medical marijuana program staff acting like cops? The patient, in consultation with his or her physicians, should be the ones deciding when and if cannabis should be used. The program is a registry. It is not their obligation to monitor patients' medical contacts. This is an attempt to restrict the numbers of patients in the program. It is also meant to intimidate physicians by having the Oregon Department of Health looking over their shoulder. It does not support physicians. Page 3, lines 31 and 32, this is a request to exclude patients who have been convicted of violating ORS 475.992. A few lines later, program staff request that convicts be forever barred from the program. This means any patient who is convicted of growing cannabis illegally loses the protection of the registry program forever. It sounds like double punishment for a crime. To exclude people who are dying or suffering from life-threatening illness based upon their previous criminal conviction is draconian and cruel. In nursing school, I was taught that if a patient says they're in pain, then they are. This provision cares nothing for people, and if passed, will push patients into the arms of unscrupulous police. Page 4, lines 15 to 17, this addition changes the simple process of card renewal where physicians simply affirms that the qualifying condition still exists to longer documentary requirements patients and doctors must complete with the initial application. This restriction, again, questions the physician's judgment and is simply not needed. If passed, it will cut a few more patients from the program. Page 4, lines 30 to 45. Here we have a lengthy exhortation to physicians that will increase the reporting requirements and paperwork load of doctors and further sour them on the program. Requiring physicians to notify the program if diagnosis changes does not support patients. This unkind and burdensome requirement may cause large numbers of physicians to withdraw from the program, creating another wave of thousands of unregistered patients being victimized because they could not comply with the law. It bogs people down in administrative technicalities and again displays a mindset that cares less for patients or physicians. Page 6, lines 1 to 2, of all the obstructive provisions in this bill, this requirement is perhaps the worst. It forbids patients from being designated primary caregivers. The effect, should it pass, will be to push many patients who are growing medicine for other patients into police arms. They will then be administratively eliminated from the program due to conviction. I do not understand how an organization can in one breath tell patients they must pass educational programs to prove their worth, then in the next tell them they can't use the knowledge they've been given. This is cruel. There are many improvements that this bill could make to the Medical Marijuana Act. These include the reduction of the protection racket fee, which I guess is in the works actually right now, a survey to determine the placement of anxiety in the list of debilitating medical conditions, medical surveys of registrants and program satisfaction data collection, elimination of the bizarre flowering requirement, an allowance for MDs to certify any condition in their professional judgment. I do not understand how police today could support a bill that puts suffering people back in the criminal justice system in these times of extraordinary budget cuts. Similarly, I do not profess to understand how the medical marijuana program staff can suggest a whole raft of changes, nearly all of which would cause more work, time, and effort, and eliminate protections of the patients the program is mandated to serve. It is impossible for us not to know that there is war going on today. A lot of men, women, and children are getting killed. The war against cannabis patients has been going on for 30 years, and federal police continue to destroy medicine supplies and arrest patients at every opportunity. The broken trust of cannabis patients with their government will not be repaired with this bill. It will only add more pain and humiliation. Thus, I ask you to please table House Bill 2939. Thank you for your consideration.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kathy Larson and Teresa Sheffer. Pardon me?
Can I withdraw?
Yes, you may.
Come on.
Got medical patients here, and the length has been really, really hard on us to not have the medication during this time, whatever that you've needed. Chairs and chair people, I've never done this before in my life. I doubt if I'll be able to go through all this. This would help. I do have some coffee, so you know something about what I'm. I don't know if I had them for everybody, but I didn't think so at least.
Go ahead.
Our first concern and everything was on the felony thing.
Could you give us your name, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yes, I sure can. My name is Kathy Larson. I live at 140 Northeast 72nd Street in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for reminding me I needed to do that. There are many reasons not to make it illegal for people with felony convictions to have a medical marijuana license. First, past mistakes should not preclude access to the most effective medicine. Second, the state is in desperate economic straits, and over 6,000 people gave the state $150 last year alone. Third, Many of those people are on state assistance and were able to decrease the amounts of medications that the state pays for by using medical marijuana instead. These same students have decreased their dependency on street dealers, thus keeping their drug dollars out of the hands of terrorists. Many people convicted of drug possessions and even for drug manufacture, if they were growing, are merely medical patients trying to medicate themselves and should not lose the chance to participate in the American medical marijuana program. Finally, in places where the marijuana laws had been relaxed, like Amsterdam and the UK, other crime statistics have dropped dramatically. Many people will not have drug coverage in the coming weeks due to budget cuts. This means they will not have access to medicine from the conventional pharmacopoeia. This medical marijuana program costs the state nothing while it defers the cost of medicine to the people. The fact that a person has a felony conviction does not prevent that person from deserving the same medical attention as any other citizen. The fact that many of the felons to which this law would apply are felons only because they grew marijuana for their own use. Making it illegal for felons to provide for their own medical needs will undoubtedly result in more arrests, thus costing the state even more money on top of the revenues lost by eliminating the licenses, fees to felons. And after coming here and whatever, the 47,000 patients, the majority of them are doing the right thing. There aren't that many people that are doing the wrong thing. And as far as quantity, I'd like to tell you just a little bit about my own personal experience in the last year. Me and my boys, to help me out, have gone through over 120 plants. We probably got one plant. I had a whole 5 grams. There are 28 grams and 1 ounce. It took us a total of those 120 plants produced a total of less than 4 ounces over a 2-year period. So the reality of what they're saying is absolutely ridiculous when you come down to actual reality and how to grow the plants and how to do it. Most of the people that do it can't do the physical thing of doing it, even if they do have the mental ability. And a lot of people don't mentally know how to do it anyway. When you have the marijuana that you're growing, it makes it so things are a lot less expensive. I myself am living on SSI of $150 a month. My house payment, my rent is $125. I don't get any help for it. I don't request it. I have had to take all my medical under my own thing, OHSU, in July. January of 96, said my brain was a shambles, floating in a pool of blood, and there was nothing more they could do for me. In July of 98, they were going to put me in Alzheimer's home because I still couldn't walk and talk or do anything. It took me from November 15th, 93, when my accident occurred, to January of 98 to fight all you people to get to a naturopathic doctor, which I had seen just the month before that knew me, that knew about it, to get to where I could be helped. Did it take an OHSU from 93 to 96 to dislodge my cheekbone from my jaw? I had a soft tissue internal head injury, which isn't even covered on you people's thing. Going into you, I'd be dead today, thank you, and I really resent that. But at any rate, naturopathic clinic, he started working with me in July of 98. Started working with me 6 to 8 treatments every single week. I got no help for this whatsoever. I had a back SSI thing. I gave it all to the doctor. I've had no help since then. The doctors wrote me off. So I don't know what you want to do as far as this thing and having a doctor go back and redo and everything. OHSU already had said there was nothing else they could do for me. In 95, I had a laser beam x-ray through Good Samaritan Hospital of my whole backbone and my pelvis area. It showed I had nothing but an eggshell of bone left. This is a bone disintegration I have been coping with on my own since I was 8 years old. thanks to the naturopathic doctors and the Lord and his natural herbs, I am able to walk and talk and do things today. May 21st, it took him till the end of this year, of last year, to dislodge my cheek, to finally put my brain, they had to completely take my brain apart and put it back together again without using surgery, without doing anything, dissolved tissue. Cranial sacral therapy. The cranial sacral therapies at the time were $150 a treatment. There was no way I could afford doing that at all. Say they were going to put me in Alzheimer's home July of 98 because I could not walk and talk and do things. Smoking marijuana organizes my brain. It makes it so I can get dressed. It makes it so I can take a bath. Smoking marijuana makes me so I can see. And excuse me, but the other day when I was driving from Salem down to Portland, I stopped at that rest stop and I medicated. And it made it so I could see and I could be a safe driver going back home. I would not have been safe going back home any other way. So all of these things that, all these laws that you people are putting me on are just making it very, 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 very devastating. If it had been up to you people, I'd be dead. I wouldn't be able to be here today. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Any questions? Dambo. That's all it has down. It says Dambo.
I think he's left.
He's left. Okay. Well, that was all we had signed up, and we're just a smidge over time, Eddie. Yes.
If I could add one thing in this sort of thing, I wish that, as far as this sort of thing, that they would not be so confining as to what sorts of things are actually covered under this. When I got my soft tissue internal head injury in 93, the medical profession knew absolutely nothing about it. When I got my CAT scan, and I'll have to say that was through the naturopathic clinic and Dr. Rotter, he was convicted on that one, any help that I had at that time. And they didn't even know how to read the CAT scan and everything. I was able to do it more myself. And more things need to be covered. It doesn't need to be things because you're going on just the little kind of things that the doctors, the AMA doctors know, and they aren't the ones that really know anything about it at all.
Thank you very much. Committee, have a good weekend. We're adjourned.
Close
public hearing, and we're adjourned.